It's the best bike vacation ever.
3 days of cycling in the Sierra foothills, camping under the stars, catered gourmet meals, entertainment, and in-camp activities. It's the 20th annual Emigrant Trails Bike Trek, Friday, September 8th through Sunday, September 10th. This excellent adventure attracts over 400 bicycle riders and helps support Breathe California Sacramento's efforts to improve air quality in our area and to work to eliminate lung disease. Make your plans now and start raising much-needed funds by registering today at sacbreathe.org or by calling 916-444-5900. You can ride as an individual or put together a team of co-workers or friends. Travel at your own pace through stunning scenery, then relax in a camp with massage, yoga, or a beverage from the cantina. Free training rides prepare you for the best bike vacation ever. The 20th Annual Emigrant Trails Bike Trek, September 8th through September 10th. 3 days of cycling, camping, and fun. Go to sacbreathe.org or call 916-444-5900 and sign up today.
Out today, licensed by the DOC. CBS News. I'm Steve Kathan. More rockets, bombs, and shots fired in the Middle East, and Israel says there will be no ceasefire until its two kidnapped soldiers are freed. In southern Lebanon, aid convoys are going one way, terrified civilians the other.
I'm Vicki Barker in Beirut. For Cassandra Nelson of the aid group Mercy Corps, today was an awful lot like yesterday.
The situation is still extremely dangerous, both for the civilians that are trapped down there and for the aid workers that are trying to reach them.
Another aid convoy is heading south in the morning, but organizers have received no assurances of safe passage from the Israelis.
Here at home, President Bush made it clear again today he does not think an immediate ceasefire is the answer.
The current crisis is part of a larger struggle between the forces of freedom and the forces of terror.
At a Miami speech, he called on Syria and Iran to pull the support plug on Hezbollah. New developments in the Mel Gibson DWI story. Details from CBS's Steve Futterman in L.A.
3 days after his arrest for drunk driving, Mel Gibson has entered a rehabilitation program. The actor-director issued a statement this weekend saying that he had been battling alcoholism for his entire life and would be seeking treatment. Gibson still has not specifically acknowledged making anti-Semitic remarks following his arrest. The drunk driving case, meanwhile, has been handed over to the district attorney's office.
It's a new day for the morning after pill, with the government now saying it will consider allowing over-the-counter sales of the emergency contraceptive.
While the FDA is opening the door to resolving this long-standing dispute, it's making it clear Plan B's maker has some big hurdles to overcome. It's demanding that this morning after pill be only sold over-the-counter to women 18 or older, not 16 or older, as DuraMed wants. In a letter, the FDA raises serious concerns about how the company would monitor sales restrictions, such as requiring that the pill be kept behind counters and that customer IDs be checked.
That's CBS's Barry Bagnato in Washington. From Minnesota down to Texas and east to the Atlantic Ocean, a summertime heat wave. Here's the story in the Twin Cities.
With temperatures in the triple digits, the water of the wading pool is quite inviting.
What are you doing to stay cool besides hitting the water?
I'm drinking lots of lemonade.
Been tough so far on you?
It hasn't been too bad because we're lucky and we have some central air conditioning running, so we're pretty lucky.
This pool is not nearly as busy as it would be if the temperature were 10 to 15 degrees cooler. Many are just staying inside the comfort of their air-conditioned homes. Adam Carter, CBS News, Minneapolis.
Tighter borders may be a good thing, but on the farm, it's turning out to be bad for business.
Farmers are walking away from fields for the first time in history because they don't have sufficient labor to harvest their crops.
Tom Nassif of the Western Growers Association says the field workforce is down about 20% in California. Wall Street, the Dow is down 34 today, and the NASDAQ was off 2.5 points. This is CBS News.
There are infinite dynamics in business. For instance, the just-in-time inventory that really is dynamic. Or the every SKU already has a customer dynamic. Or the I've escaped from the crushing shackles of my supply chain dynamic. How do you achieve these kinds of dynamics? Microsoft Dynamics. Software solutions that are specially designed to improve customer relationship, financial, and supply chain management. To find out more, visit Microsoft.com/Microsoft Dynamics.
Yeah, my wife's pregnant, so since she's driving more carefully now, maybe we could get a discount on our rate.
That's a real question that was put to the licensed insurance experts at Progressive Direct. When you call 1-800-PROGRESSIVE, we'll answer your questions and help you find the policy that best fits you. So whether your question's unique or typical...
Will I get a discount if I insure both my cars with you?
In fact, she will.
Call 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Progressive Direct Insurance Company and its affiliates, Mayfield Village, Ohio. Available in most states and situations.
Many state lotteries are rolling in money because it hasn't been claimed by winners.
New York is the state with the most unclaimed winnings, $75 million last year. Nationwide, more than $580 million wasn't picked up in 2005. Jill Vaughn with the Virginia Lottery.
Someone in Georgia did not come forward for an $11 million jackpot.
So what happens to the money? In some states, it goes back to the players in the form of second chance drawings. In others, it goes to the state's general fund. Most states give you up to 6 months to claim your winnings. Maryland currently has a $49 million ticket just waiting to be claimed. Mark Segres for CBS News, Washington.
Hey, it sounds like a plank for a presidential campaign. Former candidate John Kerry, someone perhaps interested in 08, is calling for all Americans to have health insurance by 2012. His plan includes expanding Medicaid to include kids and allowing people to buy into the same federal program that covers members of Congress. Steve Kathan, CBS News.
Time now for Green Talk, brought to you by Sluds Greenergy. Here's your host, Dr. Brooke Waters.
Thank you, Jim. Our guest today is author and talk show host.
Welcome to Los Angeles, where I believe the official sunscreen is now lead, isn't it, pretty much? Oh, my God, this heat. I was sweat like Naomi Campbell trying to hire a maid. It was so hot today. It was so hot in Hollywood today. Brad and Angelina adopted Ben and Jerry. Did you know that? It was so hot in Encino, Michael Jackson actually stopped at a young boy's lemonade stand and just bought the lemonade. You know the worst part about this heat wave across the country is Al Gore walking around going, I told you so. Actually, if Al Gore's movie on global warming is correct, as you know, the ice caps are shrinking. You all know about that. The glaciers are shrinking. The only thing not shrinking, Al Gore, apparently. Have you seen Al? Really not shrinking. I tell you, the heat, it puts people in a bad mood. You know, in fact, coming into work today, people were swearing like President Bush near an open mic. It was unbelievable.
Laughing at the Truth, AM 1320.
He seems literally in a parallel universe and slightly deranged as a result. He's living in a different world, not a different country.
You're traveling through another dimension. A dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mindlessness. A journey into a wondrous land whose boundaries are that of self-delusion. That's the signpost up ahead. Your next stop, the Rumsfeld Zone.
Penny, the sky's falling, and isn't opine on this and opine on that.
Donald Rumsfeld, from outward appearances, just another Secretary of Defense. Then Donald invaded Iraq. What he didn't know was that he would soon be greeted as a liberator in the Rumsfeld Zone.
It is not knowable how long that conflict would last. It could last, you know, 6 days, 6 weeks. I doubt 6 months.
Submitted for your approval, Donald Rumsfeld. He didn't plan on one thing. Well, actually, he didn't plan on anything. And now he finds himself without an exit strategy.
Who knows?
From the Rumsfeld Zone.
I feel safer and happier, more optimistic. Yes, I think America has a future, and Israel's going to thrive, and Lebanon will thrive, and Iraq will thrive, and Syria will become a democracy. Saudis will stop teaching Wahhabism, and everybody will all get along. Yeah, this is an armed madhouse. You know, when Greg Powell's named that book, he knew what he was doing. There's just no doubt about it. When he wrote Armed Madhouse, he knew what he was doing. This is an armed madhouse. You have people all over the TV that used to support this administration with all their heart and all their might and all their soul and all their pens and all their papers and all their pencils and all their word processors. Oh, they couldn't write glowing articles about Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and Pearl and neocons. We are all neocons now, once professed the now recalcitrant Chris Matthews. It's unbelievable. Even Tim Russert's starting to ask hard questions. Why, it's downright creepy what's going on with the neocons. They're like little rats jumping off of the ship now that the ship is about to explode into a million pieces, and part of those pieces are going to be American pieces. It wasn't enough that they sacrificed 2,500 American boys. No, now they want to sacrifice American civilians. We are not going to make ourselves safer by doing any of this that they are doing. This is crazy, and it's expanding as I speak. They talk this great game of sustainable peace, but they won't ask for a ceasefire. Who in the hell's going to negotiate a post-war ceasefire when the war is in post? Who's going to lead this great American army into the great American battlefield when the great American leader is Rumsfeld? Who is going to believe that America has the moral authority to be an honest broker in any region of the world, let alone in the Middle East, when we have destroyed Iraqis, when we've created a civil war there? This is the forgotten war now, Iraq. No one talks about Iraq anymore, and perhaps this was the plan. Maybe with some more dead bodies scattered around the Middle East, then we'll forget about the dead bodies that have American flags on their uniforms. Maybe we'll forget about the dead bodies that are civilians in Iraq who we decided, hell, let's torture them and speed it up. You know, I always wondered what Abu Ghraib was about. I never understood it. The Iraqi people did not know anything about 9/11. Nothing. Except that it happened. They had nothing to do with it. There was no terrorist group there that had any part of it. There was no terrorist there because Saddam Hussein would kill them. There were no religious extremists because Saddam Hussein was a secular dictator and had no time for religious fanaticism. And this is how he kept Iraq completely together. The three disparate factions of the Kurds in the north and the Sunnis in the middle and the majority Shia. This is how he did it. With brute force, yes. But with terrorists operating in Iraq? Absolutely not. We got hit with a terrorist attack. 15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia. 2 of them were from the United Arab Emirates. Why? We were attacked by the Saudis, who teach Wahhabist, fundamentalist, radical Islam, and had the nerve to be so naive as to tell ourselves that we should invade Iraq because of it? What did we think was going to happen there? When Donald Rumsfeld refused to provide them security, there was a moment in time when, even though he invaded and even though he attacked and bombed with bunker busters and daisy cutters and had the nerve to call it shock and awe, and everybody watched CNN, oh, it's about to start, everybody, come here, let's watch the death and destruction of Iraq. But it wasn't real. It was over there. And people actually said, it's better to fight them over there. What do you think? We're not going to have to fight over here now? Are you sure? What has the president done to secure the ports? What has he done to secure the borders? What has he done to secure the cities? Remember, you have a president whose Department of Homeland Security is so completely inept that when they saw a hurricane 5 days in advance on satellite, they did nothing. And now, 5 years after 9/11, we're almost on the five-year anniversary of 9/11, they decide that the best way that they can spend our American tax dollars is to secure a pig farm and a petting zoo somewhere in Wyoming and Indiana. It's almost like you're being set up for absolute destruction, for disaster, for impending disaster. It's like they're radicalizing the world by being radical. America has lost its respect in the world. Now, imagine during the Cuban Missile Crisis, imagine when the Soviet Union was the great enemy of the United States. They were the great Satan, and we hated them with every ounce of hatred. And anybody that said anything that might be even a discussion of communism was a red menace. They were marked for disaster. Their careers were ruined. They held hearings on who is and who isn't a communist. Can you imagine if during the Cuban Missile Crisis, when the Soviets literally were moving nuclear missiles 90 miles off the coast of Florida into Cuba, can you imagine if Bush and Cheney were president and vice president of the United States instead of John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Baines Johnson? Can you imagine their leadership in a Cuban Missile Crisis scenario? Well, I got news for you. They're talking about inventing a missile scenario. They're talking about inventing a nuclear showdown, a nuclear standoff. They're going to talk to you about Iran. They're going to tell you that they've got weapons of mass destruction, that they've got nukes. They're going to talk to you about how we have to act against Lebanon even more because they're nothing but an arm of the Iranian madmen. It's a proxy war. Their leadership has proven to be so full of lies and so full of, even after the lies were known lies, they still didn't take advantage of it and say, okay, but we're really here to bring democracy and then do it. Even that was a lie, to the point where no one knows why we invaded Iraq, except for a few people with theories like me who think it was because Saddam Hussein was going to have the sanctions taken off of him, and he was going to trade his oil in euros, and he was going to actually disrupt the Saudi and the OPEC power brokers because he was going to pump more than 3 million barrels a day. And the price of oil would go down. And they wanted the price of oil to go up. They could imagine a world with a $100 barrel of oil and they wanted to live to see it. This is not leadership. Not by an honest government with the moral high ground, it's not. This is fascism. This is absolute disaster. This is making, a lot of people don't even know we're at war. Because America's not been asked to sacrifice crap, except for the price at the pump. Which, by the way, is financing the very people that you claim you want to defeat on the battlefield. It's not just profits for the oil companies. It's profits for the oil manufacturers. It's profit for the crude sellers. It's profit. It's going to the same people you claim you want to fight. And yet, when it comes to giving us real information about renewable fuels and the need for it, based on science and global warming, they censor the scientists. And NASA no longer does reporting on global warming. Because they didn't like the truth. These are people who have a terrible, visceral reaction to the truth. To the point where if you're going to tell it, then you can die. Or you can have your civil liberties taken away. Or you can have your words taken away. You can have your job taken away. You can be demoted. You can be relieved of your duty. You can be made completely irrelevant to the coming wars. No one wants to hear what the peacemakers have to say anymore, not this administration, because they want their war and no one's going to stop them. They want to do what no one else was able to do since Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And the only reason why anybody was able to do it in Nagasaki and Hiroshima is because no one else had that technology. But those days are over. And I can't imagine a nuclear world with these people in charge. And that's exactly what we got. And they won't stop radicalizing the world. It's bad enough that the world goes radical by teaching small children to hate. That's disgusting. And trust me, I have no patience for it. And that's what causes people to join up with these sicko groups that want to kill civilians and strap bombs onto their body and pray that their little ones grow up to be suicide bombers. It's a sick, twisted world when people are teaching their children that the best way to live is to die as a martyr. But we're radicalizing them. We're making that seem right. And to do that is just so un-American that for people to have accused me of being anything less than a patriot now seems laughable to me today. Yes, I've been called every name in the book because I don't fold under peer pressure because a majority of people decided that Iraq was a good idea because he had a 72% approval rating, because he got away with lying. Didn't ever bend my will because I knew the difference between right and wrong. Have you gone mad? This is an armed madhouse. This country is in a bad state of affairs when this passes is the best leadership that we can find. 18 after.
The Randy Rhoads Show, where truth is the national language.
I said I want.
want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
Wrong, sir. Wrong.
This is Air America Radio.
You're listening to AM 1320, Sacramento's left channel. A liberal dose of the truth applied daily.
At Cache Creek Casino Resort, win fast, win often with Cash Fever Jackpots. Jackpots start at $20,000 and are guaranteed to hit by $30,000. Every time a Cash Fever jackpot hits, a Cash Club player wins just for playing with their card. Plus, you can check the Cash Fever jackpot total and your Cash Club points online now at CashCreek.com. So join Cash Club today and get the fever. Cache Creek Casino Resort.
What exactly you do?
I am the CBS News Foreign Affairs Analyst, and I am the UN Analyst. What I do is sit in the famous now Nicole Kidman booth that was in the movie The Interpreter, looking out over the Security Council.
Fascinating.
Scott and Sims, mornings 5:30 to 9 on AM 1320, Sacramento's left channel.
All right, I know everybody's running around saying, oh, well, you know, we had to go do what we did in Kana because, you know, they were hiding their missile launchers among the population. Well, guess what? They found no weapons. None. The whole place was leveled, and not one person that was killed was a fighter, and no arms were found in Kana. So explain that one to me. Michael in New York.
Hi, Randy. I just wanted to thank you for what you're saying about Lebanon. I'm of Lebanese heritage, and I have a lot of family who are Christian Lebanese. And I don't think people realize that about half the population are Christian. And my family, you know, have no love for Hezbollah. But, you know, my family, you know, my uncle who lives there, he worked for an American firm there in Lebanon, and was building, you know, helping build that country building a great economy in that country.
And they called it the Paris of the Middle East. I mean, it was a phenomenal story after all these years of civil war and all these years of occupation that they rose up and built what every American who has ever been there says is one of the most beautiful cities that they'd ever seen. Proving that the road away from armed militias or terrorist groups with weapons was to invite them into the political process, like Sinn Féin was invited into the political process, like we wanted, you know, give amnesty to the Iraqis who only killed an American soldier. You know, we want to invite them all into the political process. Well, Lebanon actually invited Hezbollah into the political process. And what people here do not get through their own ignorance and their desire not to know is that there is a part of Hezbollah that is still armed and that they should not be, but we've just given them a reason to stay armed instead of joining their political counterparts who put down their weapons and became part of the electoral process.
Absolutely. And my family had to leave Lebanon, and they're split up right now because some got out before the bombing of the airport, and then some couldn't. And I wouldn't say they've lost everything because, you know, they're still alive. But they have lost an awful lot, and hopefully they can return to the life that they had. It seems doubtful at this point because it seems like there's no one in sight, unfortunately.
Well, you know, when you see the... I'm sorry for your family. I really am. And I think that, you know, Lebanon really tried very, very hard to become a democracy. They did a good job of it. Syria was asked to leave. Now they were working on inviting the rest of Hezbollah into the political process. And just as it started to look really good, they said, uh-oh, they're getting too close to democracy. Let's bomb them out of existence. I can't even explain it to you. I don't even know what this is about. Do you?
Well, it seems like the reason why the United States doesn't want to get involved in this is because they sure do want to bring other countries into it. They sure have wanted to go in Iran. God knows what they have plans for in Syria. It seems like this is a Vietnam. Lebanon looks like the Vietnam of this era.
That's what the Israelis called Lebanon. Lebanon was their Vietnam.
Well,
and now they've done it all over again, and it makes no sense to me. Except
it doesn't make any sense.
And nothing that nothing neocons do makes sense to me. Nothing, because their goal is never, you know, to spread democracy or to create peace and stability and security. Their goal is always to create chaos wherever they go, which is why I think I can't understand it. I don't have a chaotic brain. I don't have a brain that responds to, you know, if I come home and my apartment's not neat and clean, or my house isn't neat and clean, and my kid isn't neat and clean, I'm like, not comfortable. Do you know what I mean? I don't respond to chaos. They only respond to chaos. And they don't care how they get chaos, because in chaos, they know how to steal. They operate so beautifully in chaos. $9 billion can be stolen in chaos. If you put me in that chaos, I wouldn't be thinking about stealing $9 billion. I'd be thinking about, how do I straighten this place out? That's why nothing makes sense. It's just creating chaos.
The Randy Rhoads Show. Radio only smarter. This is Air America Radio.
It's the Randy Rhoads Show. Weekday afternoons from noon to 3 on AM 1320. Sacramento's last channel.
It's the best bike vacation ever.
3 days of cycling in the Sierra foothills, camping under the stars, catered gourmet meals, entertainment, and in-camp activities.
It's the 20th annual Emigrant Trails Bike Trek, Friday, September 8th through Sunday, September 10th. This excellent adventure attracts over 400 bicycle riders and helps support Breathe California Sacramento's efforts to improve air quality in our area and to work to eliminate lung disease. Make your plans now and start raising much-needed funds by registering today at sacbreathe.org or by calling 916-444-5900. You can ride as an individual or put together a team of co-workers or friends. Travel at your own pace through stunning scenery, then relax in a camp with massage, yoga, or a beverage from the cantina. Free training rides prepare you for the best bike vacation ever. The 20th Annual Emigrant Trails Bike Trek, September 8th through September 10th. 3 days of cycling, camping, and fun. Go to sacbreathe.org or call 916-444-5900 and sign up today.
Encourage gay people to join in that family arrangement if that is what provides stability to a society.
Well, I think if gay people are members of families, they are already members of families.
What?
Their sons, their daughters.
Yeah. And that's where the buck stops?
That's a revelation.
The gay ceiling?
It's a debate about whether you think marriage is between a man and a woman.
I disagree. It's a debate about whether you think gay people are part of the human condition or just a random fetish.
No. They're... The question is, how do you define marriage? Where do you draw the line?
Don't go slippery slope with me, because that's ridiculous.
No, it isn't. What do you say to the polygamist?
You don't say anything to polygamists. It's completely, and that is a
Why?
Choice to get three or four wives. That is not a biological condition that I got to get laid by different women that I'm married to. That's a choice.
Being gay
is part of the human condition. There's a huge difference.
Well, the polygamists are all over this. This was
then
the
let's
practice.
Go slippery slope the other way. If government says, I can define marriages between a man and a woman, what says they can't define it between people of different income levels, or they can decide whether or not you are a suitable husband for a particular woman?
Because gender matters in marriage. It has mattered to every human society. It matters in every religion.
Dick Cheney would be a perfect candidate for someone who wants to ban gay marriage. Would that be correct? The ultra-conservative, draconian, drinks the blood of puppies. He's a guy... wouldn't he be a guy that is... He's the perfect candidate for a guy who wants to ban gay marriage, no? If you look at his voting pattern, social conservative, he's a social conservative.
He's a social conservative.
But he's not against gay marriage. Why is that?
Because of his experience with his daughter. That's right.
Exactly. And you said something earlier that was apropos of that. Isn't every gay person someone's son or daughter?
Of course.
So why is it
I don't think you want to argue that way, because all you need to do is find parents of gay children who do not think their kids should be able to marry someone of the same sex. I know you want to make the conservative, boogeyman here that, we're intolerant, we're bigots. This debate is over, John. Absolutely. Gay marriage is coming.
I know.
Because the courts have done it.
No, the courts haven't done it. They are only reaffirming the natural progression of the human condition. I don't understand why there's always a fight. They always lose. They will continue to lose. So why bother?
Well, the question is whether you think this is the natural progression of the human condition. I don't think it is. When you define it out, when you start to say it can involve anybody.
I think marriage has problems having nothing to do with gay marriage.
It has serious problems. Let's not have more.
It has serious problems, and, divorce is not caused because 50% of marriages end in gayness.
You are right about that. You're right about that. But,
laughing at the I'll truth. AM 1320.
If I let it go to the chorus, I'll never stop. I'll stop. Okay, Tom in Pelham, New York.
Wow. Can't believe I'm on. Is that our first time calling?
Oh.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So, like you, I really don't believe what I see. I don't do as much research online. Basically, from what I've gotten from reading from all the Israeli publications is that the United States is basically sitting back and letting Israel pummel Hezbollah as much as possible so that when we go and attack Iran, they won't be able to fire missiles into Israel.
Iran won't be able to fire missiles into Israel?
This is the mindset that I've gotten, is that basically that if the United States lets Israel take Hezbollah out, then at the end of the year or early next year when we go in to attack Iran, Hezbollah will not be able to attack Israel on behalf of Iran. This is the mindset.
And why are we attacking Iran?
Well, I'm not going to answer that one. Because
no one knows. And you know something? You don't go to war unless you can say why you're going to war in a sentence.
Let me ask you one question, by the way, before I go off. Did you watch C-SPAN 2 nights ago?
You know, everybody's telling me to watch this thing, and it's on C-SPAN.org, and I will go home tonight and watch it, but I did not see it.
What do you think about those guys, the professors and the people that are asking for another investigation into 9/11?
We obviously need an investigation. We never had an investigation into 9/11. Did you ever hear the air traffic controllers' tapes? Did you ever find out from a NORAD commander why there was a stand-down order that day or why NORAD wasn't in the sky? No, we never got the answers to how in the world four airplanes could make U-turns over the United States over more than an hour and a half, and we have supersonic fighter jets.
Right. Well, you know, I agree. I think that more American people basically need to wake up and realize that the president, the vice president, the secretary of state, these are all oil people, they're all energy people, they're all from the same group. That website that said they need a Pearl Harbor, and they got their Pearl Harbor, and I wouldn't be surprised if they have their hands dirty and responsible for 9/11.
Well, I do know that when the president found out that an airplane hit the World Trade Center, he didn't think it was anything that he should stop his photo op in a second grade classroom for. He thought a photo op in a second grade classroom in Sarasota, Florida, was more important than a passenger plane full of innocent people crashing into a business building full of innocent people. His priorities were just that those were them that day, and that was your president. Like it or not, that's what you can see.
He's the Manchurian candidate, without a doubt.
He has
no idea what he's doing.
Well, I think he does know what he's doing, and I think he believes that he's bringing about the end of the world, and he's ready to go.
Right.
But I don't think Cheney is, and I don't think Rumsfeld is, and I don't think Wolfowitz and Pearl are end timers. I think that they've got a grander idea about the entire Middle East becoming something that they want it to become, and screw anybody that gets in their way, and I mean screw them. They're dead. You know, they'll just kill you.
Well, that's why I think that Cheney and Rumsfeld really, they have their wits about them. I think that Bush is basically, after he stopped becoming an alcoholic, well, they say you're always an alcoholic, but when he supposedly stopped drinking, I think he was really brainwashed by these Christian right-wing fanatics. And I think there's nothing wrong with believing in God and being spiritual, but he's such a freak. Such a bumbling idiot.
But if he believes that he's working his way towards Armageddon, I just hope every single decent person out there understands that that requires the death and torture of every single Jew, which is why I don't understand why Jewish people or Zionists support this president. I don't get it. In his end-time scenario, you do understand that Jesus only comes back once Israel's destroyed and all the Christians are raptured out. And Jesus comes back and tortures the Jews in their scenario, right? That's how it works. That's what the end times little Bible story is. And obviously, there are Jewish people who are neocons who think that this is the best. I don't get it. I never understood it. Everybody loves to talk about the end times and Jesus will come back and isn't this great? But they never talk about the whole story. And the whole story ends with Jesus coming back to fight the last battle, but not before he tortures all the people left, which are the Jews, because the Christians are raptured out. Now, I don't get how neocons can support this kind of an Armageddonist philosophy. I really don't know. I don't know what good is going to come to this world or this country or Israel or anybody else's country with these people calling the shots. I don't see how this is making us more peaceful, more prosperous. I don't see how it's helping Lebanon to experience this great democracy that they set up. It was a fledgling democracy. It was a weak democracy. Israel is a fragile place. Why are they doing this? I don't understand what's there to gain. That's what I keep asking this audience. What is the gain? What is the end game? What do people get by doing this? What do they get except that they make the ultra-radical religious on the side of Islam and on the side of Christianity, they get to hate Jews. I don't get it, because the rapture right knows that they hate Jews. They know that the Jews are the ones that are going to get tortured in the end. And the Islamic fundamentalists, they hate Jews too. I don't get it. I don't see how this benefits any decent person, especially people who say they love the Jews and they never will forget the Holocaust. This drives me crazy. Adam, I don't know where you're calling from.
New Jersey, how you doing?
Hello.
You mean the rapture wrong, right? You said the rapture right.
Yes, the rapture wrong. The rapture haters. Armageddonists, end timers.
Real quickly, I'm just calling because I was just watching the network news, and of course the first story is about what's going on in Ghana, which is horrible, and it's horrible on both sides. But I don't recall this type of 24/7 media coverage with mothers screaming, carrying their bloody babies in Iraq. Do you? I mean, or is that because we bombed them into oblivion?
No, I think it's because the president refused to let those pictures be shown. That's why. He scared the hell out of the media. Why do you think there's so many available journalists to go to Lebanon and Israel? Everybody was available. When you look at CNN or MSNBC's roster of available commentators that are in Lebanon and in Israel, it's like the entire, you know, World Bureau has had nothing to cover because they're not allowed in. Look at all the journalists that were slaughtered in Iraq. Look at all the American journalists, all the Italian journalists. Every journalist with a story to tell in Iraq was killed.
I mean, Israel had missiles lobbed into their country, soldiers kidnapped, so they sort of maybe had some right to go into Lebanon where we had none, but I didn't see any of those pictures, any of those videos, and now every single day they're garnering sentiment for the Lebanese saying, oh my God, how could Israel do this? It's horrible. It's unbelievable.
Well, you know what bothers me is that our soldiers were kidnapped. We had 44 days of civilians kidnapped and held by Iranians. We had the students, you know. We didn't blow them up. And they held them for over a year.
So it's unbelievable. Thanks for my call.
I'm saying you don't go after terrorism with a full-throttled military machine. It doesn't work. That is a law enforcement negotiation. That is like a hostage negotiation, okay? It's not. It's a law enforcement. The counterterrorism is a law enforcement operation. You never can win going after an agile, you know, shadowy, sort of a faceless, nameless, I hide among civilians type person. By killing civilians, all you do is lose your moral high ground against the things that you hate the most. Terrorists. Doesn't work. How many times do they have to do it before they realize? And I know they realize it. They're not looking to solve the problem. They're looking to widen it. Roberta in San Diego.
Hi, Randy.
Hi.
Big hugs.
You too.
What was that song anyway? That was a good song. I got to find out what that was, the one that you had before you started talking again. Anyway, I'm not ready to go. No rapture for me, and I'm a Christian.
Mm.
There seems to be this dark, oozing, inhumane evil spreading all over the planet. Like, nothing should surprise us anymore. Nothing. I made a big sign about a year ago that I took to one of the first protests I went to, and it said, the Bush-Cheney regime is hurting the whole world. And, you know, people looked at me like I was a freak. What do you mean they're hurting the whole world? Well, just look around. You know, there's death, destruction, lies, horror, genocide everywhere.
There's torture.
Yeah.
When did America become a torturer?
Well, we also have...
And I mean, I really have people sitting here looking at... First, they denied it was going on. And then when the photos became evident, everybody could see them on 60 Minutes, people said, so what? So
well,
what?
It's also going on in our own country because there's a slow genocide of our seniors in this country, millions of them living on less than $1,000 a month with no health care, and now they can't get their prescription drugs. You know, this administration is hurting the whole world. I have no problem saying that. You know, we're surrounded by various forms of genocide. They don't care about the survival of the planet or of mankind. You know, and you know, are we sure that this is not the arrival of the Antichrist? I mean, you know, I never really believed in that before, but it's starting to look a little suspicious.
Look, I don't know why they're doing it. I really don't. I mean, I've given up on trying to figure out, you know, what sick people are thinking. All I know is that we need to take the keys of the nuclear engines away from them. They're not responsible people. They certainly are killing our identity as the great democracy, the moral high grounders, the hope people, the optimism people, the people with the shining city on the hill. I mean, you build a shining city on the hill, we're going to destroy it. We're going to bomb it, and we're going to kill a couple of kids. I mean, this is just not the American way. And I don't know how people made this. And if you think Mel Gibson's the only anti-Semite, you wait. You wait until people are being asked to make a sacrifice. You wait and see how many anti-Semites there really are in this country.
Well, we need to be doing a whole lot more about it than we're doing. I guess the thing that really enrages me the most is that we're really not standing up strong enough, and we're just not stopping it. And it's just continuing on day after day all over the planet. And I guess that really, really bothers me.
Well, I think that everybody that is aware of it is, you know, trying very hard to do whatever they know how to do. I mean, I've seen people organize. I've gone to peace marches. We protested against this war. I just did an anti-war protest just a month ago in New York. Do you know there were 350,000 people in the streets? And it just wasn't on the TV, so no one knows it happened. But people of good conscience and people of faith and people of hope and optimism, they've all been out. We've all Cindy Sheehan slept in ditches. She's on a hunger strike right now. Medea Benjamin, who's a little upstart and gets on my last nerve sometimes, she was in Congress the other day screaming when Maliki was there, bring the troops home. I mean, we've all tried. This radio show, it had to go national because I understood in 2003, you know, 2002, we were going to war. And people would yell at me in West Palm Beach going, nobody cares what you have to say. That's why you can't be national. And what are you going to, and even the people that were on my side, you have to go national. You have to do this. Like, you know, so it became my problem. And so I did. Everybody's got to figure out what the hell they can do because we're watching the end of the world as we know it. They're going to make it into a nuclear radiological, ew, you stepped in earth kind of a place. Take a shower before you come in here. You stepped in earth. It's dangerous. Wipe your shoe. By the way, all of Silent J's set lists, all the bumpers, are posted every day on therandyroadshow.com. Just click on music. And that was Three Doors Down When I'm Gone. It's a great song. 47 after.
The Randy Road Show. Girl Gone Wild.
Wild thing. Think I love you.
This is Air America Radio.
A liberal dose of the truth.
These boys and girls are not spare parts.
Applied to AM 1320, Sacramento's left channel.
to know you. Please, man, I be close to you. Yes, I'm so hungry. You're like water for my soul when it gets thirsty. Without you, there's no me or the other. I precise. Sometimes the world is dark and I just can't see. When the demons run all around to bring me down to negative, but I believe, yes, I believe, yes, I believe, I see the I believe. I send them home to feed for me, brought down on one knee. I fight with all of my might and get these demons to flee. Hashem's rays, fire, blaze, burn bright in, I believe. Hashem's rays, fire, blaze, burn bright in, I believe. Out of darkness comes light, twilight unto night. Crown lights, you're burning up all through the twilight. So I thank you to my God, and I finally got it right. Now I fight with all of my heart and all of my soul and all of my might. Said, what's this feeling? My love over in the hole in the ceiling. Giving myself to you now from the distance of my being. And I sing to my God songs of love and healing. I want Mashiach now. Time is such a feeling. What's this feeling? My love over in the hole in the ceiling. Giving myself to you now from the distance of my being. And I sing to my God songs of love and healing. I want Mashiach now. Stripping away the layers and reveal your soul. You gotta give yourself up and then you become whole. You're a slave to yourself and them don't even know. Wanna have to live the fast life, but your brain moves slow. If you're trying to stay high, you're bound to stay low. You want God, but you put into play your ego.
The Eastern world, it is exploding. Violence flaring. Bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
53 after Richard in Wyoming.
Yeah, hi Randy, big fan of the show.
Well, thank you.
I'm sick and tired of all these news programs getting on talking about frivolous things like what happened with Mel Gibson, when they could come up, somebody could think up an idea of possible solutions for what's going on in the Middle East. Maybe the U.S. pull out and send in a UN peacekeeping force in. And then send over, instead of having our troops over there, have some Peace Corps volunteers go over there on a village level or on a small community level and start rebuilding their infrastructure, help out with their hospitals, build some cold storage plants, stuff like that.
Well, that's exactly what Lebanon had been doing for the past year.
No,
I'm actually saying more than the past year. They have built that whole place up to be what everybody who has ever been there. People look at Beirut and they go, oh, everyone loves Beirut. It's the Paris of the Middle East. And what did we do? What did we do to it?
Every time Lebanon builds themselves up, what does Israel do? They have to try out their new weapons that they got from the United States.
Well, look, I don't understand this. I don't understand this massive attack on Beirut, on the Lebanese people. I don't get it. This, to me, I'm lost. I mean, just a year ago, the President of the United States was saying Lebanon was a model for what could happen in the Middle East, was a great emerging democracy, how fabulous it was that they got Syria to leave, and isn't this fabulous, and look at them, and they're doing well, and Hezbollah has become, for the most part, a political movement, and they're running for seats, and they're in the cabinet now, and they've put down their arms, and, you know, there was a part of Hezbollah that refused to put down their weapons. But doing this isn't going to make them do it.
If you were to look at Lebanon 30 years ago, Lebanon was the Switzerland of the Middle East. Lebanon was a beautiful country until Israel invaded the first time 25, 30 years ago. And then when Israel pulled out, Lebanon said, hey, we're gonna pick ourselves up. We're going to bring ourselves back. And they did it. And then Israel saw... this is my personal opinion. Someone in Israel saw, hey, here's Lebanon coming up off their laurels. They're becoming a economic power in the area. We got to attack them.
I don't get it. If you keep people down and in poverty and impoverished and you keep their cities and states broken, doesn't that increase the hatred rather than decrease the hatred? Doesn't making people live in poverty make them desperate and do really desperate things?
This is why I'm saying what we should do in Iraq is we should pull our troops out and send in Peace Corps volunteers. Set up small humanitarian aid projects.
Listen, we had a chance there. There's no doubt about it. They, you know, the Iraqis sat there and waited to see what we would bring. Okay? They didn't like Saddam Hussein any more than we did. But they wanted to see what we would bring, so they were very patient with us. They were very cautious but patient. And, of course, you know, looting started and insecurity for the women and insecurity for the neighborhoods. And they were screaming to Donald Rumsfeld, please, please secure our neighborhoods. Please just give us some security. We don't want revenge killings. We know that the Shia are really pissed off at the Sunnis because the Sunnis were the minority and we held power. What did they do? They unemployed all the Sunnis. They trained up militias, Iranian militias, and now they got the nerve to tell me that the reason why they got to fight Hezbollah is because Hezbollah are the wing, like the flying monkeys of Iran. Well, they just set up an Islamic Republic that answers to Iran and Iraq. I mean, what they're doing is creating chaos. They're not creating security. The Iraqi people were the most patient people I ever saw in my life. They waited to see what we would do. And what did we do? We unemployed everybody, and we let sectarian violence begin, and it was one person against another, and then we armed militias, just like Hezbollah that you hate. We armed them. These people are murderers.
You're listening to The Randy Rhoads Show. This is Air America Radio.
Of uneasy, imperfect quiet in the Middle East.
The current crisis is part of a larger struggle between the forces of freedom and the forces of terror.
Help may be on the way for folks who say, oops, after that hot date.
Today's announcement holds the potential for improving health if the FDA keeps their word this time.
This is the CBS World News Roundup Late Edition. I'm Harley Carnes. As though time is in high gear, this 48 hours of relative calm between Israel and Hezbollah. Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert saying there is no ceasefire. Israel will respond to it if they're hit and did today, striking back after Hezbollah destroyed an Israeli tank. On collateral damage, CBS's Robert Berger.
Olmert apologized for the civilian casualties in Cana, saying that he is sorry from the bottom of his heart for all the deaths of children or women. He said that Israel was not targeting civilians. He said they are not our enemies, and we did not look for them.
Meanwhile, that's in Bint Jubail, where Israeli troops pulled out over the weekend, people trying to get out.
I'm Vicky Barker in Beirut. Like ants trying to escape a burning anthill, vehicles packed with human cargo are speeding along the twisting back roads of southern Lebanon, trying to avoid the bombed-out thoroughfares, trying to get to safety before the bombing starts again. White sheets flutter from car windows, a desperate attempt to ward off death from the skies. The roads of southern Lebanon strewn with the charred wreckage of the vehicles that didn't make it through. Vicky Barker, CBS News, Beirut.
People caught in the crosshairs want a real ceasefire. Israel's cabinet has authorized an even wider ground offensive aimed at rooting out Hezbollah from its bunkers, basements, and other hiding places. CBS's Peter Mayer.
As the diplomatic focus moves to the UN, President Bush says he's determined to end the crisis that has overtaken his foreign policy agenda. His immediate goals...
Lebanon's democratic government must be empowered to exercise sole authority over its territory. A multinational force must be dispatched to Lebanon quickly.
The administration believes that military force would be one key to stopping the fighting, but the so-called stabilization troops could only move in after a ceasefire. The U.S. rejects calls for an immediate ceasefire, saying Hezbollah would likely keep shooting. Peter Mayer, CBS News, with the president in Miami.
Now this message.
To increase driving pleasure for all motorists, the Michelin Man is on a door-to-door quest to collect signatures for a petition to build an American Autobahn. Visit MichelinMan.com to learn how the uncompromising performance of Michelin MX Series touring tires can give you the confidence to achieve driving bliss on any road you travel. To find a Michelin dealer near you, call 1-800-MICHELIN. Michelin, a better way forward.
Aflac for small business.
Yeah, you cover small business?
Yes, we do.
Great, because I'm a flea.
Okay. Well, it is a dog-eat-dog world out there.
Look, I got a family business. Oh, here comes Pa.
Oh, your dad.
No, a Pa!
Well, with Aflac for small business, you get a lot of the benefits of a big business at no direct cost to you.
Oh, like a flea market? Sort of.
Visit AflacSB.com or call 1-800-99-AFLAC. American Family Life Insurance Company of Columbus. Aflac.
The morning after pill may be widely available soon. Not the abortion pill, but the one that keeps an ovum from attaching in the first place.
On the eve of the Senate hearing on his nomination to head the FDA, Acting Commissioner Andrew Von Eschenberg has suddenly revived a stalled application for an over-the-counter morning after pill. He says a long-delayed decision now could be made within weeks. But in a letter, he tells the maker of the so-called Plan B pill, the FDA must be convinced sales can be restricted to women over 18, that customer IDs will be checked, and that the drug will be stored behind counters. Even with these conditions, Ann Scheidler of the Pro-Life Action League isn't happy.
I'm sure they're getting a lot of pressure from pharmaceutical companies, the anti-population forces.
Conservatives worry this pill will promote promiscuity. Barry Bagnato, CBS News, Washington.
Nothing like a water park when it's this hot. Those kids having shrieking fun at West Allis Water Park near Milwaukee. Just to the south in Illinois, Steve Harris lives in Chicago looking for a cool glass of water.
We don't realize what the heat will do to you. And people don't have the money to buy it. I mean, it's $1 a bottle in the stores.
Temperature records have been falling like scorched flies. Records tied today in Eau Claire, 102 degrees 98 in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. In Chicago, two people have died of the heat. You're listening to the CBS World News Roundup.
There's nothing small about today's small business.
AM 1320, Sacramento's Left Channel is live and interactive at 1320leftchannel.com.
Yes!
Now you can email your local Left Channel.
At Cache Creek Casino Resort, win fast, win often with Cash Fever Jackpot. Jackpots start at $20,000 and are guaranteed to hit by $30,000. Every time a Cash Fever jackpot hits, a Cash Club player wins just for playing with their card. Plus, you can check the Cash Fever jackpot total and your Cash Club points online now at CacheCreek.com. So join Cash Club today and get the fever. Cache Creek Casino Resort.
Of the Majority Report on Air America Radio.
We are back on the Majority Report, Air America Radio, streaming at airamericaradio.com, blogging
the Nobel-nominated blog, MajorityReportRadio.com. On the phone, it's a pleasure to welcome back Ron Suskin. He is the author of the New York Times number one bestseller, The Price of Loyalty, George W. Bush, the White House, and the Education of Paul O'Neill, and the latest, The 1% Doctrine, Deep Inside America's Pursuit of Its Enemies Since 9/11. Welcome to the program, Ron.
Nice to be here.
Your book is fantastic, and there's been a lot of stories that have come out of it. But give us a synopsis of the book. What is the 1% Doctrine?
Yeah, the 1% Doctrine, Sam, is the core of the U.S. playbook in the post 9/11 era. It comes from a meeting in November 2001. The vice president's being briefed in the Situation Room about Pakistani nuclear scientists having sat with bin Laden and Zawahiri just a few weeks before 9/11. Obviously, this is a harrowing combination of actors. And he says, you know, if there's even a 1% chance that WMDs have been given to terrorists, we need to treat it as a certainty, not in terms of our analysis or the preponderance of evidence, but in our response. At this moment, the vice president thoroughly severs the United States from the dictates of evidence. This 1% rule, Cheney Doctrine, there are different names inside of the government, essentially guides often ferocious action in Iraq, the global war on terror, Afghanistan, all the way through. Evidence doesn't matter. That's what Cheney says. Now there's real accountability on that subject.
Do you think that they've actually followed that? I mean, I understand the notion of, like, you have risk is a function of likelihood and of its implications. But do you think they've actually followed that doctrine?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, like, every step of the way, the message was evidence, real evidence, the kinds upon which Western democracies are based, rule of law, really. It's simply too high a standard for the kind of battle we're in now. We're never going to get evidence. Suspicion will often be the guiding light of action, the threshold, frankly, for the most powerful nation in the world and what it decides it wants to do. Now, you know, the fact is that some folks, because this is a cause of fierce debate around the country, now that we can actually see the doctrine, the core of the playbook, some folks say, hey, what choice did he have? Other folks say this is exactly what has gotten us into so much trouble, where our actions create more problems in so many cases than they could ever solve, especially when they're born of something shy of evidence, born of often nothing more than suspicion.
So this really, in some ways, this notion of the 1% doctrine actually cuts into the doctrine of preemption and really brings it to the doctrine of prevention.
Precisely, precisely. And I think what you're saying and seeing is precisely the kind of dialogue we need to be having now. Prevention is the guiding standard, not preemption. Preemption is born of an evidentiary process. We need a smoking gun, then we act. And when the president is out there saying preemption, the Bush doctrine, he's not really being straight with the American public. He knows it. It's prevention.
And it's not really, we're not even talking about a smoking gun, because that implies that the gun has been shot off. What you're talking about with preemption is you need to know the gun is loaded. When we talk about prevention, we're just saying that there's a chance they may have a gun.
There's a chance they may have a gun. There is a reasonable suspicion that they have intent and may or may not have capability. That is plenty, essentially, for the awesome powers of the United States to be engaged. That, of course, I think explains a lot of what we're seeing now, 5 years after 9/11.
Now, the Bush administration obviously has not necessarily been straight with the American public in that regard, have they? Because they haven't completely discounted the need for evidence when it comes to selling the American public.
No, absolutely. You know, what the book shows time and again, readers are, I mean, I'm getting overwhelmed with calls and notes from readers. Books are selling out around the country. They're saying, I finally get it. I see it. The ups and downs, the swells of a kind of spy thriller with the future of the planet at stake, this war on terror. At the same time, they're saying, you know, yeah, they're heroes in that part of it. But this other part, where the administration essentially is using disinformation when it comes to its own citizens. You know, information is a weapon of the war on terror. Don Rumsfeld has said it, others as well. And the book shows clearly that that weapon is used to tell Americans that black is white and up is down when the administration decides it needs to do that. You know, that, I think, goes right to the heart of what we call informed consent and accountability in a democracy. We can finally have that discussion.
So when we hear the notion of protecting America, that's really not necessarily that can be interpreted in a couple of different ways, can it?
Sure, of course. You know, protect it from itself, protect it what we decide it needs to know or doesn't. The upshot is that throughout the book, readers are seeing the actual threat, the actual responses, what really has occurred, almost all of it behind the shroud of secrecy, so that they can now make a decision. You know, time and again, we'll catch a terrorist, and the administration will oversell who that terrorist is. There's almost no way of offering an informed response to that because the actual raw information is hidden and kept sealed under the classified standard. Now people can look at it time and again in the book and go, good God, now I see it clearly.
Now, do you think that all players in the White House are sincere in their notion of their belief that this risk from terrorism exists, or is their belief founded in the notion that it's also an expedient belief to have in terms of their other agendas?
You know, sometimes I think it's hard for them to differentiate between the two. I think that generally folks feel in and out of the administration, in and out of the terrorism community, that the threat is real. I don't think there's much doubt about that. When they look, however, especially the people fighting the fight, I call them the invisibles, the folks really in the day-to-day battle, when they're fighting it, and then they look at what the administration may have said about this or that or some of its public actions that are making their battle more difficult because the administration's decided politically they need to do something that's expedient, maybe say something that's not true, maybe cast something in a way that's not accurate, maybe release a bit of classified information that actually is misleading rather than enlightening. The invisibles, the people fighting the fight, say, why are they doing this and making it harder, not easier, to win this real fight, this war on terror?
Well, what do you think the answer is to that? I mean, is it simply that there's a certain amount of incompetence, or is it that their agenda is broader maybe than that?
Well, their agenda, I think, is, you know, the administration is very tactically forceful. Their view generally, Sam, is win first. The rest is for later or for never, or a time of our choosing. In many cases, you find that being the guiding principle.
But I guess what I'm getting at is, are we sure that we know what their definition of win is?
Win is win the news cycle. Win is win the next election. Win is, in many cases, Americans need to know only and precisely what we decide they need to know. That will create consent, even if it is uninformed. That is advantageous. Look, for any administration, this or anyone to follow, the war on terror provides a kind of creative license. A war fought in secret. Think about that.
Mm-hmm.
That goes against much of our experience. Wars tend to be public things. You know, there are dispatches of correspondence on the front. This one is almost all fought in shadows. And what that means is that for something so central to an ideal of a citizen's view of what a government should or shouldn't be doing, a war is largely going to be guided by what they decide you ought to know. That's what we're fighting right now, these issues of transparency and accountability, so people can look at clearly the nature of this new kind of battle. It's a new kind of struggle. It's not, you know, the old, you know, tanks and bombers. It's going to be going on probably to the lives of our grandkids. And people need to understand how to fight it and how to win it without compromising what makes democracies unique.
You know, it's interesting because once you start with that 1% doctrine, it reminds me of a schizophrenic who's otherwise rational, but except for the first basic assumption that they make. Because once you have decided on that 1% doctrine, everything else, this gives you license. And I guess this is what you examine in your book. This gives you license to do anything.
Yes, it does. It does. It does. To do whatever is needed, however it is needed, whenever it is needed. And when the means, Sam, are often carried forward in darkness and secrecy, traditionally, those means often go awry. You know, things that, frankly, we'd rather not admit in daylight, even if the ends are noble. I think that's something that history tells us again and again. Here's a case where almost all the means are carried forward in secret. more and more, though, just because that's the way the world works these days, is that the stuff comes out, and what happens is we lose our moral departure point. And that's where real power and authority and an ability to convince others comes from, moral power. That's the thing that we've lost.
All right, we've got to take a break. Can you hang with us for a
minute? Sure, yes.
Okay, great. When we come back, we'll talk about the implications of the Hamdan case on cracking the, I guess, everything that accrued from that that belief in the 1% doctrine. We'll be right back. We're talking to Ron Suskin. He is the author of the 1% doctrine, Deep Inside America's Pursuit of Its Enemies Since 9/11. This is the Majority Report.
The best of the Majority Report on Air America Radio.
You're listening to AM 1320, Sacramento's Left Channel. Streaming live at AM1320LeftChannel.com.
Messages. Of course, we're after Saddam Hussein. I mean, Bin Laden. He's. Let me say, I certainly hope so. Before I.
If you send messages.
That's a loaded question. First of all, I admire Senator Kerry's service to our country.
If you send messages.
I admire the fact that he is a great dad. We're facing
If you send messages.
Let me finish. And so the answer to your question is, no doubt about it, it's tough.
hard work.
The only way duct tape protects you from a chemical attack is if you have enough that you could wrap it around yourself and suffocate before the chemicals killed you. As soon as they told us that we should protect ourselves with duct tape, immediately a group of citizens should have been sent to Washington on our behalf. And they should have taken everyone from the president on down out for an afternoon of electroshock. Just to get them back on track. Just to get them back on track.
Of the Majority Report on Air America Radio. Back to Sam Cedar on the Majority Report, Air America Radio.
On the phone, Ron Suskin, author of The 1% Doctrine, Deep Inside America's Pursuit of Its Enemies Since 9/11, available at bookstores everywhere. Ron, we were just talking. I want to ask you this question. I want to get to the Hamdan case in a moment, but I want to just focus again on this and just clarify something. As you watch the news and right. You hear about Korea and you hear about Iran, and particularly what's striking to me is Somalia, where we see basically Islamist extremists taking over that country. Certainly I would think a 1% risk.
Yep.
That you're going to have another training ground for Al-Qaeda there.
Right.
And then with the knowledge that comes out, brought to us by Senator Russ Feingold, that the administration has one person working on it, do you start to think that maybe this 1% doctrine is, in fact, more political than it is really about our national security?
You know, you think about what it takes to check 101% chances. Now think about 1,000. Now think about 10,000. The core of this is when you have, really it's not even a strategic doctrine, it's more a tactical doctrine, where you are following ghosts, blind leads in many cases. Just a 1% chance is enough to move in some direction. What you find is an America that's overwhelmed and stretched much too thin. You know, we are trying now, even inside of the government, there are folks who are debating this, to try to come up with a doctrine to replace this one. Because they said, this is not really a coherent strategy. A coherent strategy deals with not only the tactical issues, but broader hearts and minds issues. So we're not creating ever-widening groups of people around the world who are angry at the United States and moving, at least in high percentages, higher than we could have expected, toward violence. The fact is, if it's 1 out of 1,000 angry people who move to violence, that's a lot of people. If it's 1 out of 100, that's an army beyond which we can ever really challenge or face down. That's the broader issue, is we need to win the hearts and minds battle. We haven't thought very clearly about that because this muscular, unilateral 1% idea is creating a backlash of more problems, frankly, than we could ever solve.
So I mean, just to nail this, you would see the 1% doctrine as a failed strategic doctrine rather than a political doctrine or a doctrine developed for political purposes.
Absolutely. This is the internal centerpiece of the government's policy. It's not been publicly exposed till now. So it's not really for public consumption, certainly until this moment, but it is what's driving U.S. policy. And I think now we can say, is this really the best we can do? And look at both some of the advantages, some of the things that are valuable from moving in every direction, often like a headless chicken, to try to go after every possible 1% chance. On the other hand, we need to have actions that flow to a broader strategic goal, so that we can have real forward progress. We haven't pulled that off yet.
Well, I'm no defense expert, but I got to say that the 1% doctrine seems absolutely ridiculous to me, because obviously you're spread a little bit thin when you look at this strategically, and it just happened to be really, really politically convenient. But
it does, yes. You're absolutely right. It also happens to be politically convenient, but you're absolutely right.
All right, now let's move on to the Hamdan case.
Yeah.
Do you think, because the Hamdan case really struck at the notion that the commander-in-chief can do whatever he wants in a time of war and that he can throw out our political and our legal processes. Do you think this really lays that doctrine to rest?
Well, you know, I think certainly the Supreme Court has stepped in and made its response to the 1% doctrine. That's what it essentially does. You know, the president has said, I can do whatever I want for whatever reason I want to do it, if there's evidence there or not. The Supreme Court says no. We are a country ruled by laws, not men. The rule of law, frankly, is based on evidence and based on an ability of people to see their accusers. And this system of government is one that should champion the fact that we can handle what we're facing within our system, not in extra-legal cul-de-sacs. That's what the court said. Everyone's trying to catch up, Sam. The Congress is, the courts are. The administration was so far out in front, guided mostly by Dick Cheney. The book points out clearly the relationship between Bush and Cheney. Cheney is the global thinker, the pair, that everyone now is trying to catch up, the court included.
Right. All right, we just have about 30 seconds left. Tell us why you cite George Kennan and who he was at the end.
George Kennan. Kennan says clearly at the end, he's the great global thinker, one of them of the 20th century, a pragmatist, developed a containment policy instead of throwing our nuclear-enhanced might at Russia. And Kennan says, look, if you're not mindful of the fact that means matter as well as ends, you will lose ultimately your moral departure point, and that's where true power comes from. And his advice to the United States is be mindful of that, and you will actually have a foreign policy again.
All right, Ron Suskin, thank you so much for joining us. The 1% doctrine, folks, buy it everywhere. Right after you buy FUBAR. I will be right back in the Majority Report. Thanks, Ron.
The best of the Majority Report on Air America Radio.
A liberal dose of the truth.
The internet is not something that you just dump something on. It's not a big truck. It's a series of truth.
Applied daily. AM 1320.
It's the best bike vacation ever.
3 days of cycling in the Sierra foothills, camping under the stars, catered gourmet meals, entertainment, and in-camp activities.
It's the 20th annual Emigrant Trails Bike Trek, Friday, September 8th through Sunday, September 10th. This excellent adventure attracts over 400 bicycle riders and helps support Breathe California Sacramento's efforts to improve air quality in our area and to work to eliminate lung disease. Make your plans now and start raising much-needed funds by registering today at sacbreathe.org or by calling 916-444-5900. You can ride as an individual or put together a team of co-workers or friends. Travel at your own pace through stunning scenery, then relax in a camp with massage, yoga, or a beverage from the cantina. Free training rides prepare you for the best bike vacation ever. The 20th Annual Immigrant Trails Bike Trek, September 8th through September 10th. 3 days of cycling, camping, and fun. Go to sacbreathe.org or call 916-444-5900 and sign up today.
Be responsible on your boat will be well worth my time. Visit boatsmarter.com and remember, if it's your boat, it's your responsibility.
Defender, written for the New York Times. The Nation has a op-ed in the L.A. Times today.
Yesterday.
Yeah. And author of Indefensible, One Lawyer's Journey into the Inferno of the American Justice, And it's gotten great reviews.
Well, thanks. Yeah, it's doing reasonably well.
Well, that's good.
That's what the book is for.
For people to read it.
Exactly. And review it nicely.
Exactly.
In fact, I only wrote it for people to review it nicely.
Yeah, exactly. Now, tell us about the book and why you wrote it and what in your life led you to write this.
Well, I was a public defender for about a little more than 12 years, and I basically wrote the book because I just got unbelievably pissed off and fed up with what the justice system was doing to my clients. And the upshot is the book, in many ways, is about my outrage. Really, it's wrapped in a single day in my life as a public defender in the South Bronx. It's about how the system fails poor people every single day, how it does terrible violence to my clients and their communities. And it answers, I think, the question a lot of people have, which is, how can you defend those people?
So. Right. Well, before we get to that question,
yeah.
so this book, it's all true stories.
It's all true.
It's okay.
Absolutely. It's one day.
And now, so tell me, well, how can, well, let's start with this. How can you defend these people?
Because I like them. Look, there are a lot of people out there and a lot of public defenders who will say, well, the system, you know, it has to have two sides, and they're very process-oriented. They're the people who can do either side. I couldn't do either side. I could not imagine spending my life putting other people in cages. It just grosses me out. I just find it just an unbelievable act of hubris. That being said, I do think being a public defender is unbelievably righteous. And why do I do it? Because I come to really like my clients, and it really sucks when they go to jail.
Now, I mean, but I mean, obviously, you're representing people who have committed crimes,
many
right?
Many of them
and,
have.
And do you think in general that no one deserves to go to jail? Or
Very few. I think there are some people. In fact, I've represented some of them. But you know what? There are 600 murders a year in New York City and 300,000 arrests. You know what those other 299,400 are? They're nonsense. They're trespasses, and they're 60,000 marijuana cases. I mean, think about that.
Wow.
60,000 marijuana cases every year in New York City. That's what we're spending our tax dollars on. That's an absurdity. And no, those people should not be going to jail.
And those people often do go to jail.
They do occasionally. And even when they don't, they're saddled with criminal records. They're saddled with fines and court costs that they can't pay, that screw them in terrible, terrible ways. And the collateral consequences of even marijuana or drug cases, minor drug possession cases, are astonishing. You can get deported for that. You can be here 20 years working legally, paying your taxes, having a great life, and pick up one little case. Next thing you know, you're on the plane back to wherever it is. And by the way, stranding your family, leaving your wife without support, it's atrocious.
Right. And then, of course, we all pay doubly for that as well.
Absolutely. And somebody's paying. You know what? American Airlines is not deporting them for free.
Right, exactly.
We're paying those plane tickets.
And then we've got to deal with what remains of their broken family.
Absolutely
well.
Right. And we have to deal with incarcerating them until we do, which is appalling.
Now, tell me, do you think that the problems that you experienced in the New York system, and let's be, before we extrapolate, tell us a little bit about the problems that you saw in terms of, you know, the process and
right.
in terms of, you know, the waste or the corruption or whatever it is. I mean, explain it to
me. Well, it's all of the above. I mean, I don't think I have to tell listeners here, God knows, that, you know, money does in many ways buy justice, as does access. And my clients, I was a public defender. The one unifying fact of every one of my clients is they were poor.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is they often rotted in jail for tiny bail amounts that they couldn't make. That was one of the most appalling things for me, is watching somebody sit in jail because they didn't have $500. Not only didn't they couldn't find a family member or a friend who did. Think about that for a second. Literally, your freedom depending on $500 and being unable to do that.
No, tell me this. What is the theory here of bail in this instance? I mean, because we know that, you know, if I go to jail and I don't have $500 to get
right.
out on bail, this is a much more severe punishment than if I have millions of dollars.
That's right. I'm so glad you asked that. And it's one of the things that's most misunderstood. The reality is, look, bail is supposed to ensure your return to court. But, you know, excuse the finger quotes. But it doesn't. What it really is, it's designed to coerce pleas from poor people. That's how people use it. The truth of the matter is, when we're arresting this many people, we cannot possibly give them trials. There's just no way. The system is too overburdened. And if we have to dispose of 90%+ of the cases, which we do, and almost 99% of those misdemeanor cases, we've got to coerce pleas. This is the dirty little secret of the system. Everybody in the system knows it, and that's what happens. So they put people in jail, and public defenders like me wind up saying things like, look, buddy, I know you're innocent, but you cop now, you walk out. Otherwise, we'll do motions practice, but you'll be sitting for another month. That's the truth. It's gross.
And that's basically what, I mean, do you find yourself in that situation a lot?
All the time. It's funny, because people are like, oh, that couldn't really happen. Ask anybody who is a PD. It happens all the time. It was a daily part of my existence. And when I talked earlier about the outrage that led me to write, you know, Indefensible, there's a reason I call it Indefensible. That is part of the indefensible system.
Now, is bail, when they calculate bail, is it always a function of the crime that they're accused of? Is it a function of their wealth?
No, I wish. Now, let me clarify that a tiny bit. It's not generally, in the cases that I did, have anything to do with wealth. It is a complicated thing, but I can't tell you there's a grid. It's really, you know, the judge goes, $500, $2,500. If you spend a lot of time in the system, as I did, one of the little parlor games when you're in arraignments is trying to predict what the judge will set, and you get pretty good at it. You know that it's a robbery. I'm guessing $10,000 over $5,000. Bail set at $10,000 over $5,000. You're like, ka-ching, right. You know. You get good at knowing what judges are going to do because you spend so much time watching it. But different judges do different things. Some judges will let one person out where that same judge would set a $1,000 bail that they couldn't make. So sometimes you're in the position in night court of counseling a client, look, man, I can get you in front of the judge tonight, but sit tight. Tomorrow morning we'll get somebody who will let you out. Whereas tonight, if you don't have $1,000 or you don't have somebody who's going to get it, you're going to rot for a week.
Right. So you're having to game the system on some level based upon the different personalities.
Absolutely.
Because there's a certain arbitrariness to it.
It's very arbitrary. And in fact, I would say, yes, it's gaming the system, but I would say you're not doing a good job unless you try to game the system on behalf of your clients. I make no apologies about that.
Right. And because everybody else is
sure.
gaming the system in the same way, and you're doing your client a disservice if you don't do the same.
Absolutely. And, you know, look, the judges are playing a game too. The judges are reacting to social pressure. The judges are reacting to public pressure to be tough on crime all the time. And that's why they're doing this stuff, you know. A judge in the Bronx once said to me, you know, nobody ever wound up on the front page of the New York Post for setting bail too high.
Right.
That's the guiding principle. It's really unfortunate, but so, there you have it.
So in addition to bail, which is used as a coercive instrument to just clear the dockets in a way, what are other elements that are really problematic in our justice system, at least as you experience?
Well, again, I could make larger critiques. I could talk about the legalization of drugs or the continuing war on drugs. Those are obvious. The book, in a lot of ways, is about the little things. It's about the frictional cost of the system that nobody else sees. For example, how long it takes to get a trial. And it's the same thing. You know, there's a whole section, a whole chapter of Indefensible that's about somebody who just hypothetically hopped a turnstile. And you know, they're not going to go to jail. It's clear at the outset. It's given. The premise is you're not going to go to jail. But you know what? If you have to come back 8, 9, 10, 11 times, and every single time you're taking vacation, you're jeopardizing your job, you're screwing up, you know, at some point you just go, look, man, I can't fight this anymore. Give me my one day of community service. Give me my $50 fine. I'll plead. Just get me the hell out of here.
Why would someone come back 8 or 9 times for a turnstile?
Well, you know, people like to protest their innocence when they're innocent. You know.
And so what happens? They actually have a case, or I'm not sure?
Yeah, you get arrested. You know, they bring you downtown. They say, hey, you know what? We'll give you a trespass and a $50 fine. You go, dude, I didn't do this. You know, the token was stuck. I asked the officer to just look in there. I mean, obviously we don't have tokens anymore, hypothetically.
Right.
Or whatever, you know, whatever the crime is. Look, I didn't do this. And public defenders like me will smile and say, look, you have the right to a trial. I'd be happy to help you with that, but you got to know it's going to take a long time. And a lot of people at first are like, look, this is a principle. I'm innocent. I'm not pleading. And they get ground down over the course of 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 15 court appearances without getting a trial, spending, you know, 3, 4, 5 hours sitting in court, unable to read a newspaper, waiting for 30 seconds before a judge.
And why is that? Just because it's so filled up?
So filled up. If I took you up to the Bronx tomorrow, I could show you pages and pages of names of people just waiting, filling basically every single courtroom. If you watched it, you'd be astounded at how much it looks just like a factory. It's like one after the next. 30 seconds here, 30 seconds there, a plea's entered, it's over, one after the next. The system is jam-packed. We're talking more than 250,000 people a year shoved through our system.
Now, is this a problem that is unique to the Bronx, or is this something that is...
It's totally universal. Now, that's not to say in some corners of, you know, Alabama, in Virginia, rural Virginia, that it's the same way there, as I understand it. You can get a trial reasonably quickly, and you don't get very many adjournments. But in every big city that I know of, and in every big system, it is this kind of crush. I mean, wasn't there some celebrity just released from L.A. County Jail after, you know, 5 days of a 40-day sentence or something like that?
I wasn't going to talk about it because that was a sort of a dark period.
Oh, no.
But the cat's out of the bag.
Yeah, there you go. Well, congratulations on
being
out.
People thought I was on a book tour.
That's right. I'm glad you made it.
It was one stop. I read it over and over again.
Exactly.
All right, now, what would you suggest in terms of if you had the ability to reform the system,
mm-hmm.
where would you start?
I'd start with legalizing drugs, and I'd start with changing our policing strategies radically. Look, I don't believe broken windows works. You know, it's funny.
Tell us what
the whole theory of broken windows was. I think William Julius Wilson basically said, "Look, it was if you're walking down a street and there's a window that's broken and it's left broken, it encourages crime because it encourages an environment of lawlessness." This was a long time ago, I think originally in a Law Review article, but it was really the overarching policing strategy that Bratton et al.
This is William Bratton. He was under Giuliani. And the idea was we're going to pick up people for any small infraction, and that this will have a ripple effect.
Correct.
And we'll also take people we may be looking for off the streets, that type of thing.
The idea is arrest every turnstile jumper every once and again, they'll have a gun. Arrest every guy on marijuana, eventually one of them will have a gun. The problem is, you know, that sounds real good, but number one, it doesn't work. And number two,
let's start with number one. How can you say it didn't work? Because, you know, we have crime rates have gone down.
Crime rates have gone down. It's funny. I was thinking about this the other day. I was just reading Freakonomics. And, you know, Levitt and Dubner's theory is that the biggest contributing factor was the legalization of abortion. That basically, did you read this?
Yes,
it was actually very interesting and provocative. And I think more likely than not, I'm gonna go with Stephen Levitt on this one. He's a much smarter economist than I am.
Okay, and so it's not necessarily attributed to what Bratton did. It just happened to be. Because, of course, this also happened across the country.
Across the country.
So
that's
it wasn't
the
simply
whole thing.
New York.
Right, exactly. I don't buy that it was the policing strategy. From what I've seen, I can't cite you the specific study, but from what I've seen, the broken window stuff really is not the major factor. But what it has done is it has eviscerated poor communities. It has done extraordinary violence to a large over-policed population who I wind up representing because I'm a PD.
Now, how has it done that type of violence?
Because you're arresting people over and over and over. Look, if you try a dropsy case, a dropsy case is police say, I arrested you, Sam, with a gun, mm-hmm. right? Your defense is, look, man, I was walking down the street, cops saw a gun, they threw us all up against the wall and said, it's yours. Now, that sounds like nonsense in Manhattan. People, you try that case in Manhattan, you're likely to lose because people are just like, oh, that doesn't happen. You know, you try that case in the Bronx, that's an acquittal. You want to know why? Because not only has it happened to two-thirds of the jury members, the other third have seen it happen.
Right. This is where they come up, they drop a gun down, and they...
Or they find somebody. Everybody's running. They coordinate, you know, cop cars screech up. They coordinate it off. Somebody's tossed it. They're not quite sure who. And they go, somebody's going
to... It's a random sweep of everybody down the block, essentially.
Yeah. So, you know, like I said, that's the sort of policing that you would never believe happens if you grow up in Manhattan or if you live in Manhattan. But in the Bronx, everybody knows it happens.
All right. When we come back, I want to talk about the Supreme Court upholding the notion of spot searches of parolees.
Okay.
And also, as to the implications of race on this, and get deeper into what it does to a community that is subjected to this type of policing.
Okay.
We'll be right back on the Majority Report. We're talking to David Feiga. He is the author of Indefensible: One Lawyer's Journey into the Inferno of American Justice. We'll be right back on the Majority Report.
The best of the Majority Report on Air America Radio.
It's Enid Live, weekday afternoons from 3 to 7 on AM 1320.
Sacramento's Left Channel.
hot today in New York City, that naked guy on the subway was screaming, "Who's crazy now?" Hot. Hot down in Washington, D.C., Dick Cheney replaced his pacemaker with an ice maker. It's so hot, Christy Brinkley is now dating Ben and Jerry.
Whoa!
It's so hot today, ladies and gentlemen, George W. Bush told Al Roker to stop doing that shit. That's what he said. That's what President Bush said at the G8 summit. He was overheard using a dirty language at the G8 summit. And not only that, later he was ejected for headbutting.
Whoa!
Yeah.
Laughing at the truth. AM 1320.
Hey, listen up. What about your future? Are you unhappy with your current job? Want to make great money and get the promotion you deserve? Now's the time. Explore your options. Log on to stackjobs.com and post your resume today. That's stackjobs.com. Post your resume and have local employers find you now. New companies being added each day and hundreds of jobs are being added each week. So if you're in the market for a job, stackjobs.com is a click away. At stackjobs.com, you're on your way to a better day.
Don't want to be an American idiot. Don't want a nation under the new media. And can you hear the sound of hysteria? The subliminal mind f***ed America.
Is in studio. He is the author of Indefensible, One Lawyer's Journey into the Inferno of American Justice. He's got an op-ed out in the LA Times yesterday. And we're talking about the violence that is perpetrated among communities that are subjected to this type of policing that we have in New York, the broken windows theory,
right.
This notion of just... It's a different form of justice, and when we were just talking about this, and I told you the story that I had a friend in L.A. Who was black, and we were going to his house, and we pulled into his garage, and another buddy of his drove in who was also black, who was driving a Range Rover, and he got out of the car, and he goes, "I just got pulled over by another cop." This is the second time this has happened this week.
Right.
He's in a brand-new Range Rover. He said, "I called the cops." And I said, "Is there any way I can get a sticker that says I own this car?" And
can you imagine being in a position of having to ask the police department for getting a sticker saying you own the car? I mean, think about that.
And the cop said on the other end, he said, "You're black?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "There's really nothing we can do for you." And this notion of what, you know, and I was saying, like, if this had happened to me, I can't imagine. I think I would have gone insane.
Yeah.
And the amount of energy I would have expended on just dealing with this issue, you know, every time you get in your car, you got to worry about this.
Right.
So is this analogous to what's going on in communities across the country?
I totally think it is. I mean, I'm fond of saying, Sam, look, if they policed the dorms of Columbia University like they policed the projects of the South Bronx, there would be a revolution in about a week. I mean, literally, imagine this. You know, they do these things called vertical sweeps, all right, in the Bronx. You pull in a bunch of cops. They seal off downstairs. Some start at the roof. Some start on the ground floor, and they work their way up. They throw everybody in the halls up against the wall. They say, "What are you doing here? Let me see some ID. Who are you going to see?" right? You say, oh, I'm going to see my friend so-and-so. You know, he's on the third floor. Now, these are big project buildings. So, like, some guy in 2231 is going over to the house of somebody in 2233. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's just swinging by, and the guy's not home. Well, that's a trespass. They get arrested for that. Not just once, not just twice, not some random occurrence. It happens all the time. I could take you up to the arraignment court in the Bronx right now. I promise you, you'd see one of these cases.
Now, what is the theory behind, why do the cops do this?
It's Operation Clean Halls, my friend. Operation Clean Halls, you know, it's like they're sweeping the projects. But the problem is, they're sweeping everybody up, and for nonsense. And I have stood time and time again in front of a judge saying, Judge, look at, we call it the CJA sheet, the one that verifies where they're. This kid lives in the next building. For God's sake, he's going over to see. And, you know, they should dismiss these cases, and by and large, they don't. They sit there and they say, well, he can have a violation and a $50 fine or 2 days of community service. And by the way, this is after they go through the system. That is to say, they get handcuffed, they get fingerprinted, they get mugshotted. They're in the system, right? They're in the mug books. And then they go downtown, and then they spend a night in jail. I mean, it's horrifying stuff. If we did that to students at Columbia, there would be a revolt. Can you imagine the calls from irate rich parents to the mayor going, what the hell are you doing? My friend, my son was going to see his friend. And then, let's make it even worse. Let's say they toss your apartment for drugs, and they come up with some weed. Right? Imagine. I have no idea, but I would suspect that you would find some in the dorms of Columbia University, except that it's safe there. It's not safe anywhere else. Right. It's certainly not in the Bronx.
Right.
You know, and fine. Then you wind up with a trespass for one guy, a weed case for the other guy, and pretty soon everybody at Columbia has lost their scholarships, have criminal records, and they're out on their asses living very much like my clients wind up living.
Now, this is do you see this as primarily a function of economics or of race?
That's interesting. I think neither. I think it's about access. I really do. In a certain way, I think that race and class become proxies for access, which is to say, if this happened to you, you would find somebody to complain to. Right. You may not know the police commissioner, but I promise you, you would find somebody who knows somebody, and you would work those phones, and you would find a way to make your voice heard. And I guarantee most of our, you know, wealthy listeners would find a way, maybe not them, maybe their parents or their third cousin, they would find a way because they would be pissed off and they would try to make it right. My clients are so disenfranchised and voiceless, they've got no access.
All right, we
got
to go. We're running up. It's David Feige. The book is Indefensible, One Lawyer's Journey into the Inferno of American Justice.
The best of the Majority Report.
You're listening to AM 1320 KCTC,
Sacramento.
Sacramento's left channel, because you deserve the truth.
CBS News. I'm Harley Carnes. It's hot and dry. More than 60% of the country's in a drought. Temperature records have been dropping along with the integrity of electric power grids.
They've been over 100 for about 4 or 5 straight days.
A plaintive note in Joe Stark's voice there at a Denny's restaurant in Bismarck, North Dakota. The temperature hit 100.9 degrees in Minneapolis, Minnesota today. First time since 95, and it's the hottest July since 1935.
The water of the waiting pool is quite inviting.
What are you doing to stay cool besides hitting the water?
I'm drinking lots of lemonade.
Been tough so far, honey?
It hasn't been too bad because we're lucky and we have some central air conditioning running, so we're pretty lucky.
This pool is not nearly as busy as it would be if the temperature were 10 to 15 degrees cooler. Many are just staying inside the comfort of their air-conditioned homes. Adam Carter, CBS News, Minneapolis.
It's so hot in the Midwest, the operator of the electric power grid for 15 states in the region says it's tough to keep up.
Conservation is never a bad idea when the weather is this warm. Folks should consider putting off using high draw appliances until later in the evening. Just the common sense things like that would certainly be helpful.
Carl Dombeck at the Midwest Independent System Operator. Israel plans to go back to work after the 48-hour hold on airstrikes. CBS's Dan Ravine.
A late-night session here, Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and his security cabinet gave the army the okay to expand the ground offensive into Lebanon. More troops and tanks have been seen in northern Israel heading toward the border. We're about halfway through a suspension of the Air Force bombing campaign, but airstrikes are likely to resume after the 48 hours are over. And Prime Minister Olmert, in a speech, said the war will continue until the threat of Hezbollah rockets is eliminated.
President Bush huddles with Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, but not to talk about a ceasefire.
President Bush says he's still opposed to an immediate ceasefire along the Israel-Lebanon border.
See, stopping for the sake of stopping could be okay, except it won't address the root causes of the problem.
He told Fox News in Miami he thinks the Israeli bombing of Khanna was terrible, but plenty of Israelis are suffering too.
It's also awful that 1 million Israelis are worried about rockets being fired from their neighbor to the north.
Back at the White House, President Bush meets with Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice as she returns from the Middle East to plot the administration's next move on bringing calm to the region. Howard Arenstein, CBS News, Washington.
Survey finds 1/3 of married people would like someone else to decide medical questions when health fails.
There was somebody in the family that they both wanted who was more savvy, more knew their way around the system better.
Dr. Michael Lipkin at Northwestern University. Mel Gibson, box office monster, acknowledges saying some pretty monstrous things when he was arrested for suspicion of DUI. Prosecutors could bring formal charges this week. Wall Street, the Dow lost 34 points, NASDAQ off nearly 3. This is CBS News.
To increase driving pleasure for all motorists, the Michelin Man is on a door-to-door quest to collect signatures for a petition to build an American Autobahn. Visit MichelinMan.com to learn how the uncompromising performance of Michelin MX Series Touring Tires can give you the confidence to achieve driving bliss on any road you travel. To find a Michelin dealer near you, call 1-800-MICHELIN. Michelin, a better way forward.
I want to let you in on a little secret, but before I do, could all you car dealers, bankers, and credit card companies switch over to the All Sappy Love Songs All Day Long station? Good. For the rest of you, here's the secret. FreeCreditReport.com. If you know your credit score going in, you may be able to cut a better deal on car loans, refis, even credit cards. And you'll find your free credit score and report at FreeCreditReport.com. That's the secret. Get your free credit score and report with enrollment in Triple Advantage at FreeCreditReport.com. Get the score.
So many transplants planned, so few kidneys to go around.
About 89,000 Americans are waiting for kidney transplants. In this country, donors are either people who are living or declared brain dead in hospitals. Spain has had success transplanting kidneys from people who suffer from cardiac arrest outside of hospitals. Now, a study in the Annals of Internal Medicine finds that survival rates are roughly the same for these donors as for others.
CBS News correspondent Barry Bagnato. The key is to be able to harvest the kidneys quickly before they decay. An unusual announcement from British Prime Minister Tony Blair and California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. A joint effort to explore ways to fight global warming, bypassing the federal government. Collaborative research into clean-burning fuels and technologies and a credits system like the utilities and big industries use to pollute. This would be to emit greenhouse gases. President Bush has rejected the idea of ordering cuts in the production of carbon dioxide so far. Harley Carnes, CBS.
The Randy Rhoads Show.
The gays want to do exactly what no one wants to do. They want to serve in the military, and they want to get married. Pull that.
These are troubled times. We have to think our way out. We can't faith our way out. It's not a coincidence that so much of Bush's base are faith people, because Bush works in mysterious ways. It helps to have faith. It really does. But religion, it stops people from thinking because they think all the answers are in that one book. It impedes progress. It justifies crazy people. Flying planes into a building was a faith-based initiative. Matters of otherwise common sense become points of debate. Like gay marriage, would we even be having this discussion about whether gay people can marry except for religion? Of course the Catholic Church doesn't want gay men to marry. Half the priesthood would walk out the door the first day and marry the UPS driver.
Of the Majority Report on Air America Radio.
We are back on the Majority Report, Air America Radio, streaming at airamericaradio.com, blogging at majorityreportradio.com. My name is Sam Cedar. Janine Garofalo back on Friday in studio. Sharon Weinberger, she is the editor-in-chief of Defense Technology International, a bi-monthly editorial supplement to Aviation Week and Space Technology, which I am an avid reader of.
Oh, excellent. Many people read it cover to cover.
And author of a great new book, Imaginary Weapons, A Journey Through the Pentagon Scientific Underworld. Welcome to the program, Sharon.
Thanks for having me.
Now, some of the stuff in this book is shocking.
Yeah.
Is shocking the right word? I mean, this is... It's unbelievable. And this is actually on a day where George Bush announced that he was very proud that all the money that is accruing our national debt is all spent on the Pentagon, essentially, and on the military stuff. Now, this book uncovers, I guess, inside information from a sect of our government or section of our government that people know a little about. Give us a synopsis here.
Actually, I like the word sect because that's kind of a lot of it. There's, in reporting on defense technology in the Pentagon, I kind of realized over the years that there is this subset, sort of a sect of, sort of true believers in the Pentagon who attach themselves to sort of, fringe or wacky technology ideas, things that they think will be panacea for whatever war on terror or transformation that they're looking for. The one I focus on in the book is this concept of a nuclear hand grenade. There's a host...
No, it's like a nuclear hand grenade.
Yeah, this is actually an idea that dates back a couple of decades, where you get nuclear weapons designers together in a room, and they sort of theorize, wouldn't it be great if we could get a small nuke in a small package, and
that you could throw.
Well, that's always the joke behind it. What on earth would you do with it?
Well, I know, but I mean, when these guys are sitting around, they're talking about a nuclear hand grenade. Now, I'm not a scientist at all, and I'm not a specialist in weapons at all. But it seems to me that if you have you wouldn't be able to really throw it far enough so that it wouldn't do damage to the thrower.
Yeah, well, exactly. That and a host of other problems.
No, why is it so easy for me to realize that? But guys who are sitting around in a room, they don't realize that.
Because they simply ignore the practical, everyday problems that would be you'd encounter with something like a nuclear hand grenade. And just the idea that if you could only have a small mini nuke, think of the things you could do with it. I mean, and that's the thing. Most sane nuclear weapons designers throw it out as a joke. The idea of, could you make it small? But, this book is about some people who took the idea really seriously and just went with it.
Now, are these people paid by the U.S. government?
Yeah, I mean, there's basically two parts to the group that I focus on. One are sort of the scientists on the fringes who promote these ideas, and then the other part of it are, some true believers in the Pentagon who support, fund, and sort of foster and grow these things to fruition.
I mean, this escapes me. I mean, what does that mean to be a true believer? I mean, you have to be a lunatic.
Well, yeah, that could be one definition. I mean, to give an example, of ideas, and some of them are based in real science, there's this thing that's been thrown around for a while called the voice of God weapon.
And this goes back to a very, very real science phenomenon, you know, auditory effects caused by microwaves. And so for decades, you know, every few years, someone will say, well, wouldn't it be great if, you know...
Wait a second, I got to stop you there. Auditory effects caused by microwaves.
Basically, so microwaves at certain frequencies will make it sound like there's sounds in your head, you know, buzzing clicks. And, you know, we've known about this for decades. We kind of understand what causes it. But, of course, you always get some Pentagon officials said, you know, what if we could make voices? And so they've actually, you know, looked into this, you know, ways to make, you know, use it as voice transmission.
So the idea would be to make people think they're going crazy.
Exactly. Or more specifically, why it's called Voice of God is to make God, you know, make you think God is talking to you. And this sort of, you know, got renewed attention after 9/11. You know, what if we could think, you know, what if we could make Muslims think God is telling them to surrender? And, you know, it's another idea that doesn't go away.
Wow. And so how are they doing with that?
You know, well, they've been funding.
First off, I guess they would have to hire people who speak Arabic, I mean, for it to work. In that they're certainly in short supply, I think, probably, in our administration.
Right. Yeah, that's the thing. If you can't even find people who face-to-face can speak Arabic to people, then you kind of got to wonder if they'll be able to master it in a weapon. You know, like a lot of weapons, like a nuclear hand grenade, there's a host of practical reasons why you probably won't be able to convince Muslims that God is speaking to them. But again, it's just the idea that, you know, wouldn't it be great if, you know, let's forget the practicalities.
Well, I'm actually interested in this weapon, because if there was a way to maybe beam it towards maybe somewhere like certain states or certain times where they're having like a Republican convention or something, that might actually be a very useful tool.
Yeah, there could be lots of uses for it. And, you know, if you ask the Air Force about it, they just say, well, it's classified.
Now, wait a second. So now pull the microphone up here a little bit, because I want people are going to think this is a hoax. Are we? How much money has been invested in these things?
Well, in these things generally, in sort of fringe, wacky science ideas, you know, depending on how you count and what you think is fringy, from the tens and hundreds of millions all the way up to the billions. Some people think missile defense is completely, you know, wacky.
Well, that's just because there's been, what, a dozen tests and they've all failed.
Well, yeah, pre-scripted. you know, if you can't make it work when you have all the, you know, all the information ahead of time, how would you make it work on the fly? That's, yeah.
So, and by pre-scripted, you mean basically they know where the missile's coming from. They know what its trajectory will be. They're able to put in everything. They're going to be able to program everything.
There's a little beacon in their test missiles that they go that basically, you know, beams all the information down. So unless North Korea wants to put that beacon on one of its missiles to tell us exactly, you know, where it's taking off, its trajectory, and where it's going, I think that an operational test would be real hard for them to master.
Well, Sharon, maybe you're not thinking about the Voice of God machine.
Yeah, somehow
because
that might
if you add the Voice of God machine, you could maybe get, you know, you could get the Reverend Sun Myung Moon. You could get his voice. You could use the Voice of God machine to tell them to put in a tracking beacon into the missile.
Propose it to the Pentagon. They might fund it.
Well, I may be looking for some type of employer shortly. And why do we continue to expend taxpayer dollars on these things? I mean, is there, for every 100 of these crazy ideas, do we get one that is really great?
Well, that's the idea, and that's part of what is wrong but shouldn't be wrong. The Pentagon controls a vast amount of our basic research and, you know, science and technology dollars in the country. They've done some great things. You know, the Internet came out of ARPANET, a Pentagon project.
And wasn't it Al Gore, actually, who helped bring it to, I think, the civilian population?
Everyone likes to claim credit for that one. You know, and so what they say is high risk, high payoff. If we invest in 100 ideas and, you know, one of them is so great and it works, then that's a good investment strategy. But the counter argument to it is if you only invest in the really stupid ideas, none of them are going to pay off. And you've just hurt the science and technology base of the country. You've also hurt the credibility. I mean, taxpayer dollars.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the theory is the idea that, well, we place 100 bets, one will come through is fine. But you really should do some due diligence on those 100 bets. That doesn't just mean that you fund
exactly
a nuclear hand grenade.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, sort of like, you know, Las Vegas. Well, you know, high risk, high payoff there, too, but the house is always going to win. If you don't use, if you don't have some sort of check and balance, you know, scientific peer review, or even just listening to the experts, you're really bound to fail.
Now, has this phenomenon increased under the Bush administration? Is this something that they have been more open to the notion of wacky science?
I think it's less that they're open to wacky science, but more, and a lot of reporters have written about this and talked about this, that they're very happy to simply ignore advice. You know, a part of it is it's a long-term trend that a lot of the scientific positions we had in government have disappeared, and that's less for nefarious purposes than just benign neglect. But certainly under this particular administration, they have been very willing to just say, science, what do we need that for? We have policy goals, we need things we need to accomplish, and, who needs technical experts?
Right, and this is also something we see, whether it's, we see it dealing with the FDA, we see it with the EPA as well. There's been in some of those agencies, there's been an explicit attack on scientific research because it interferes with their policy agenda.
Well, yeah, and you see this a lot, more and more specifically in the Pentagon. When the Bush administration came in, they made very clear they wanted a missile defense system. And, I think very early on, Rumsfeld sent out a memo to sort of the old true believers in missile defense saying, this is how we're going to argue it. It's like the Corona satellite launches. Those failed several times over, but eventually they worked. But that was a technical issue. And it's the idea that we don't need any scientific review of our programs. You're starting to see this a lot in the nuclear weapons debate. There's a lot of controversial issues in nuclear weapons, but it is this administration's policy that there shouldn't be restrictions on thinking about building or developing new nuclear weapons.
These are tactical nuclear weapons, correct?
No, we're still talking about in the realm of strategic nuclear weapons. There's a big debate over, how to upgrade and modernize our nuclear weapons. But rather than having that debate play out between credible scientists, the administration just sort of jumped the wagon and said, we need a new warhead. And you actually have those in Congress, even Republicans in Congress, saying, well, wait a minute, maybe there should be some sort of analysis of this before you just kind of go ahead and tell us to fund things.
Yeah, like, for instance, why would we need a strategic nuclear weapon at this point? I mean, don't we have literally thousands of them?
Yes, but they do age, they do degrade, and there are questions about, these things don't last forever. And so that's why we employ, armies of scientists at the weapons labs to tell us how long will they last, what will we do, what will we need.
So you're saying the Bush administration calls for the development of new ones without asking those people, do we need them, when will we need them, how long will they last, what should we do?
That's the concern of even some Republicans in Congress. Basically, the first they wanted funding for a robust nuclear earth penetrator, what's colloquially called the nuclear bunker buster. And that, when that sort of failed to gain support in Congress, then they went after something called the reliable replacement warhead, which, some think we need. But the problem is, and the concerns are, that there's never been a thorough analysis of it, and that they've kind of used nuclear weapons as an ideological tool, that, we just need them. We want to make sure no one restricts us, so let's just request something. And a lot of it think it's what it's really about is trying to create an argument for why we need to be testing nuclear weapons again. That's sort of what critics think is that's sort of the real end goal, that they want an excuse to end the moratorium on nuclear testing.
Well, there's certainly, this administration certainly has a modus operandi of just doing things and creating a situation where it creates a necessity that wasn't there before. In other words, we've got to stay in Iraq because we're there.
Right.
Without actually even having a legitimate debate as to whether or not we should go in, create those facts on the ground and attempt to meld the rest of the world around it.
And that's exactly the concern in the nuclear weapons realm, that they're sort of trying to create an argument that isn't there. Well, we need to test nuclear weapons because we've developed a new one. That's the concern, and it may be. There's certainly those in the weapons laboratories who are concerned about the arsenal and think that maybe something is necessary, but those debates need to play out among scientists who understand it.
All right. We'll be right back. Sharon, when we come back, I want you to tell me some of the really... I mean, the nuclear hand grenade is pretty crazy, but this stuff with antimatter weapons, right? And psychics?
Yeah, there's a fair number.
All right, well, when we come back, you're going to talk to us, tell us more. Sam Suter on the Majority Report in studio. Sharon Weinberger, author of A Journey Through the Pentagon Scientific Underworld, entitled Imaginary Weapons. We'll be right back.
The best of the Majority Report on Air America Radio.
It's the Morning Retort with Scott and Sam.
Weekday mornings on AM 1320.
Sacramento's last channel.
It's the best bike vacation ever. 3 days of cycling in the Sierra foothills, camping under the stars, catered gourmet meals, entertainment, and in-camp activities. It's the 20th annual Emigrant Trails Bike Trek, Friday, September 8th through Sunday, September 10th. This excellent adventure attracts over 400 bicycle riders and helps support Breathe California Sacramento's efforts to improve air quality in our area and to work to eliminate lung disease. Make your plans now and start raising much-needed funds by registering today at sacbreathe.org or by calling 916-444-5900. You can ride as an individual or put together a team of co-workers or friends. Travel at your own pace through stunning scenery, then relax in a camp with massage, yoga, or a beverage from the cantina. Free training rides prepare you for the best bike vacation ever. The 20th Annual Emigrant Trails Bike Trek, September 8th through September 10th. 3 days of cycling, camping, and fun. Go to sacbreathe.org or call 916-444-5900 and sign up today.
Saturday, August the 26th at Mather Field in Rancho Cordova. Join members of all branches of the military, police and fire departments, and runners of all ages for a day of fun and drills in the mud. Spectators are welcome free of charge, and there's plenty of food and great raffle prizes available. To register or to find out more, go to MatherMudRun.com today.
The best of the Majority Report on Air America Radio. To Sam Cedar on the Majority Report, Air America Radio.
We are back in studio. Sharon Weinberger, editor-in-chief of Defense Technology International and author of Imaginary Weapons, A Journey Through the Pentagon Scientific Underworld. Now, we're talking about some of these ridiculous, I guess, you could call them weapons programs, right? I mean, they're being funded by the taxpayer.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
And you follow one guy who, tell us, what's the guy's name and what is it that he has developed, quotes?
The main character in this book, and sort of it follows his story, is Carl Collins, who is a professor at a small university in Texas, the University of Texas, Dallas. And in 1998, you know, he'd had a lot of money in the Reagan era under Star Wars, that big ballistic missile defense shield that was going to protect us all.
And that never worked.
No.
And in fact, it's been shown to be almost, like from a physics standpoint, impossible. Is that correct?
Yeah, even some of the supporters of it now say that the ideas were a little flaky, some of them.
Kurt Weldon, but go ahead.
Congressman Weldon very much supports it. But anyway, this gentleman, Carl Collins, had gotten a lot of money back in those days for some of his schemes that also didn't really work out. And he was sort of scraping along, and in 1998, some friends of his got the Pentagon to give about $100,000 to his wife to buy a very radioactive material called hafnium. And so his wife had the hafnium, this material, and he bought a used dental X-ray machine for $1,500 and, you know, basically beamed the X-ray photons at the hafnium material and claimed he had triggered the energy. The stuff stores energy. And, you know, it went into a prestigious physics journal, and immediately the preprint started circulating through the CIA and DIA and weapons laboratories because the results, if true, could theoretically be the workings of sort of a new type of nuclear weapon, this, you know, nuclear hand grenade that some people wanted. And, you know, immediately a lot of scientists began to doubt it. It seemed odd, you know, the whole dental X-ray thing. It violated some physics that they knew. And, you know, then people started to explore it. You know, one State Department arms control official had an outside group look at it. They said it was, you know, bunk and not really a good experiment and wouldn't be a bomb anyway. And then some other scientists tried to repeat the experiment. Didn't work. And, you know, but this guy, Carl Collins, had some, you know, friends in the Pentagon who believed in him and believed in his work. And, you know, next thing you know, there was an arm of the Pentagon that was talking about putting $30 million into it. They had assembled experts to, you know, can you build power plants to produce hafnium?
So this is really the story of, like, I'm going to prove to them I'm no mad scientist,
exactly.
That type of thing. And it turns out, like, I'll show them who is mad, that type of thing.
Yeah, very much.
And then we give him millions of dollars, and it turns out we're really the ones who are lunatics.
Yeah, but the essence of those in the Pentagon who believe in this stuff is they just don't give up. And, you know, there were more advisory boards and more scientists complaining. But, you know, these folks in the Pentagon just said, no, wait, you know, give this, you know, it's always, the answer is always one more year, $10 more million, more people, more experiments. We'll find a way.
So we only got 30 seconds left. How much money are we talking about that is wasted on this type of stuff?
You know, on a smaller fringe project like this one, you know, $10 million to $20 million.
But overall?
Yeah, it's like I said, if you count some of the flaker schemes in missile defense, it could be in the billions.
In the billions of dollars.
It depends how you count it, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Fascinating, slightly terrifying, and really sad use of our tax dollars. But you know what? Those kids don't need those free school lunches anyways.
Yeah, they can always buy a bomb.
Exactly. All right, Sharon Weinberger, thank you so much for joining us. The book is Imaginary Weapons, A Journey Through the Pentagon Scientific Underworld. When we come back, Steve Earle of Air America's Steve Earle Show, or The Steve Earle Show. Well, that's going to be one of the questions we ask him. We'll be right back on The Majority Report.
The best of The Majority Report on Air America Radio.
You're listening to AM 1320, Sacramento's left channel. A liberal dose of the truth applied daily.
It's the best bike vacation ever. 3 days of cycling in the Sierra foothills, camping under the stars, catered gourmet meals, entertainment, and in-camp activities. It's the 20th annual Emigrant Trails Bike Trek, Friday, September 8th through Sunday, September 10th. This excellent adventure attracts over 400 bicycle riders and helps support Breathe California Sacramento's efforts to improve air quality in our area and to work to eliminate lung disease. Make your plans now and start raising much-needed funds by registering today at sacbreathe.org or by calling 916-444-5900. You can ride as an individual or put together a team of co-workers or friends. Travel at your own pace through stunning scenery, then relax in a camp with massage, yoga, or a beverage from the cantina. Free training rides prepare you for the best bike vacation ever. The 20th Annual Immigrant Trails Bike Trek, September 8th through September 10th. 3 days of cycling, camping, and fun. Go to sacbreathe.org or call 916-444-5900 and sign up today.
On Saturday, August the 26th, at Major Field in Rancho Cordova. Join members of all branches of the military, police and fire departments, and runners of all ages for a day of fun and drills in the mud. Spectators are welcome free of charge, and there's plenty of food and great raffle prizes available. To register or to find out more, go to MajorMudRun.com today.
Hey, you streaming listeners, open your media player and click on the link to NoHaggleMortgage.com right now, and you can save thousands on your mortgage loan. Simple, easy, and takes less than 30 seconds. For the first time, homeowners can now have direct access to the same rates that mortgage brokers get. That's right, the same rates that mortgage brokers get. Three things allow NoHaggleMortgage.com to get the lowest mortgage rates in the industry. One, no commissions to pay loan officers. Two, most of the work is done over the internet, saving you a lot of money.
free, no haggling. Click on the link now, then click on Quick Quote to find out what rate you can get. Get your money faster and save thousands. No gimmicks, no middleman, no haggling. Just simple, fast, friendly, low-rate mortgage loans. Skip the loan officer. Go direct to nohagglemortgage.com. You're already online. Take 30 seconds and find out for yourself. Or go to nohagglemortgage.com. Check it out today. Licensed by the DOC.
The Morning Retort with Scott and Sim.
To understand it.
Mitt Romney.
What drives people?
Massachusetts governor. If he can't protect his own citizens from tunnels, how will he protect you from terrorists? Done. Campaign is dead. See how easy it was?
It was that easy.
See, that's the problem on the left. You're the problem right there. You got all, you think you get all the answers to the, all the little questions that does not drive a lot of people outside of California, outside of both coasts, outside of California and New York. Northeast. I mean, this is not the world. This is not the center of the universe, Mr. Sims.
If Romney gets the nomination, the tunnels win. Think about it. Taurus, Terra, Earth, tunnels.
Do the math, Scott!
It's very erotic. I'm being turned on by all this talk.
Scott and Sims, mornings 5:30 to 9 on AM 1320, Sacramento's left channel.
The fact that somebody like Rush Limbaugh, who has made a career preaching that anybody who does drugs has got to go right to jail, do not pass go, no questions asked, right to jail, gets caught doing 30 OxyContin a day. 30 OxyContin? Do you have any idea how high that is? I don't, and I've been pretty high. But, wow. This guy is putting up Elvis numbers, ladies and gentlemen. But how does he get away with it? They say, well, he's on medication. Oh, see, that's not drugs. You know what, pal? We all got our medication, don't we? They can have an ad on TV that said, ask your doctor if Jack Daniels is right for you. And it would not be out of place thematically.
Best of the Majority Report on Air America Radio. Back to Sam Cedar on the Majority Report, Air America Radio.
Just a moment, we're going to be talking to Sean Wilentz, author of the Rolling Stone magazine cover piece, The Worst President in History? Question mark. One of America's leading historians assesses George W. Bush. Man, I'll tell you something. I am still pissed. Some notion about Atrios made a comment about some writer. I just don't get it.
Do you remember 8.5 weeks ago, Janine was talking about something she bought from Sephora?
No, I don't. The fact of the matter is that when we had Howard Zinn on prior to the election that was stolen for the second time in 2004. And he said it. He said on this program, like, you know, John Kerry is a toehold, period. And that's exactly how I view Democratic control of the Congress. I mean, if anybody thinks that there isn't a substantive difference, they're kidding themselves. If there's anybody who thinks that the Democratic Party is the answer, end of story, you're also kidding yourselves.
Well, the whole thing is a process. No one individual, no one set of people is the answer. I mean, the whole thing is a process.
But we have, we have a creeping fascism in this country. We have a Republican-dominated lawmakers who seem to be asleep on the job. I mean, that's the biggest point I want to talk to Sean Wilentz about is basically, you know, can you have... Really, can you have the worst president in history without also having the worst Congress in history? George Bush is planning his comeback, though, apparently. This is hilarious. This is from Time magazine. Josh Bolton, the new chief of staff, is coming with his 5-point plan. It's a recovery plan for Bush. Here is the Bolton plan, according to Time magazine. I'll just read a couple of these. Deploy guns and badges. Number one. play to the members of the base who are worried about illegal immigration. Under the banner of Homeland Security, the White House plans to seek more funding for an extremely visible enforcement crackdown at the Mexican border, including a beefed-up force of agents patrolling on all-terrain vehicles. It'll be more guys with guns and badges, said a proponent. Think of it as, think of the visuals. The president can go down there and meet with new recruits. He can go down to the border and meet with a bunch of guys and go ride around on an ATV. This is their plan. This is why the immigration thing is such a joke. I'm going to be on CNBC tomorrow morning.
About 8:20, I think.
You tell me.
Yeah, 8:20 Eastern.
A.M.
A.M.
That's ridiculous. On the Squawk Box. I don't think they're going to like what I have to say.
No, I imagine they won't.
Because it's not going to go into necessarily with the agenda that all immigrants are bad.
You're going up,
and we need to build a 40-foot wall.
You know who you're going up against? Is this Michael Shmerkanish guy? Who is that? Is, you know, is at least, you know, a dull enough kind of instrument who's, he's, as Bill Scherer was saying to me, is willing to come out and say, well, you know, we should profile the Muslims.
Yeah, of course.
And it's you know, it's really
now. What I want to know is it why they actually have to get real recruits? Why don't they just hire a bunch of actors from L.A.? Have them go down there, like get the cast of one of these you know, bad syndicated action shows. Get them down there. Bush can take his photo op. He can stuff his pants. He can wear a one-piece suit.
It'd be funny to get the guys from Reno 911.
Yeah, exactly. And he can ride around on his ATV. And hopefully he doesn't, you know, doesn't fall off it. Number two, make Wall Street happy. In an effort to curry favor with dispirited backers in the investment world, they will focus on two tax measures already in the legislative pipeline. Extensions on the rate cuts for stock dividends and capital gains. So in other words, let the investing class make more money. And folks, I got news for you. You're not in the investing class. You're not, if you're not a professional working on Wall Street, you're not in the investing class. You're in the sucker class. We need all these financial TV shows to be talking about how great the economy is, and that only happens when their guests from Wall Street talk about it, said a presidential advisor. This is very popular with investors.
Yeah.
Why is the stock market going up? Because they're just printing money, like the Fed's printing money like it's going out of style. And all this liquidity is going to come back to bite in the ass with inflation. That's part of the reason why gas prices are going up so much, is because the dollar is being devalued.
What number are you on?
I haven't gotten to number three. This is your favorite, right? Brag more.
Oh, yeah. we didn't make this up. This was in Time?
Yeah. White House officials want Bush to brag more about Medicare's new prescription drug plan. Wait till seniors get a hold of, A, the donut hole, which is going to hit soon. The donut hole is this huge gap in funding on the prescription D plan. You get the first $1,500 or $2,000 paid for you, and then it's like you don't get payments again until around $5,500. And then wait until the May 15th deadline comes, and seniors who haven't been, 43 million, I think, some ungodly number. People on Medicare and Medicaid have not signed up for this plan yet, and they're going to get screwed. They're going to be either put into a plan where they're not getting the right medication, or they're going to get fined, or they're going to get left out.
Yeah, bragging about that hasn't gone so well.
No, I don't think so. And then, this other proposal that kicks in June, which is like a sop to the anti-immigrant forces in this country.
Oh, the ID thing.
The ID thing. And there's going to be a lot of elderly.
No, wait a minute. What does this do?
The ID says that supposedly to catch illegal immigrants from getting Medicare services, it's going to require either a passport or a driver's license to prove that you're an American citizen. Now, how many 80, 90-year-old people do you know have a driver's license? What is it, something like 30% of the American public has passports?
Yeah.
How many 80 or 90-year-old people do you know still have their passport? And then a lot of people...
Yeah, among those 30%.
And then if you, older black people were not given birth certificates. A lot of older people were born in their homes. They weren't given birth certificates. Oh, you should definitely brag about that. You should remind everybody that it was the Republican Congress who shoved this thing through. I don't don't know what our pal Eric called in or whatever his name was about the prescription D Medicare plan. But the fact of the matter is, whether it's Katrina, whether it's New Orleans, whether it's this plan, whether it's bankruptcy bill, people die and go broke because of this administration. What else is he going to... He's also going to brag more about the economy. These aides want him to trumpet the lofty stock market and stable inflation and interest rates. Well, inflation's not so stable. Maybe they came up with this plan a little bit before the last inflation numbers came out. They also plan to highlight any glimmer of success in Iraq. Well, we didn't have 100 U.S. troops die this month. It was only Iraqis who passed away. Number four, reclaim security credibility. Number of terrorist incidents around the world, top 10,000 for the first time in the history of the world. Presidential advisors believe that by putting pressure on Iran, Bush may be able to rehabilitate himself on national security. What? Something like over 50% of the American public does not trust George Bush. 54%, according to the LA Times Bloomberg poll in April 11th. 54% of the respondents did not trust Bush to make the right decision about whether we should go to a war with Iran. I wonder why. All right, when we come back, hopefully we'll have Sean Wilentz on the program. As if you needed a historian to tell you, he's going to explain to us why George Bush might be the worst president in the history of the United States. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report.
The best of the Majority Report with Janine Garofalo and Sam Cedar on Air America Radio.
It's the Randy Rhoads Show, weekday afternoons from noon to 3 on AM 1320, Sacramento's Left Channel.
I was in the water before I knew what happened. I reached up to stop an or two from going overboard. The next thing I knew, I was overboard too. Watching my boat, there was nothing I could do to avoid being hit. The first time the propeller cut through my back. The second time, it cut my hand and arm. A moment of operator inattention, a lifetime of can't forget. Because I survived, I can tell you how important it is to be responsible on your boat. Visit BoatSmarter.com and remember, if it's your boat, it's your responsibility.
This is an AM 1320 Left Channel Very Active Action Calendar. Have you ever wanted to learn how to salsa? Or do you already know how to salsa and just want to have some fun? On Friday evening, August 4th, it's the Durston for Congress Latin Dance Night. It's a night of lively salsa dancing, good company, and a sharing of ideas.
So, put on your dancing shoes. The Durston for Congress Latin Dance Night will be held this Friday from 8 to 11 p.m. at the local 946 Machinist Union Hall at the corner of Sunrise Boulevard and Citrus Road in Rancho Cordova. If you don't know how to salsa, don't worry. The evening will include salsa dance lessons, a salsa dance demonstration, and a talk by Bill Durston on the topic, A Country of Immigrants. For more information, call 916-622-VOTE or go to Bill's website, Durston, D-U-R-S-T-O-N, for Congress.org. That's this Friday, Durston for Congress Latin Dance Night.
Time? The Town and Country Democratic Club is organizing the 2006 California State Fair Democratic Booth on behalf of the Sacramento County Democratic Central Committee, and they're looking for volunteers. Those who have volunteered at the booth at the fair over the years have found it to be a fun and rewarding experience. This election year is sure to offer additional excitement, so you'll be promoting democratic values, registering voters, and providing a platform for many Democratic candidates running in the November election. The State Fair runs from August 11th through September 4th. If you'd like to get involved and help staff the Democratic booth at the California State Fair, go to the Sacramento County Democratic Party website at sacdem.org and click on Events.
Majority Report on Air America Radio. Now, Sam Cedar on the Majority Report, Air America Radio.
Now, the problem we have is you got some person out there in Central Texas needing a worker, and he can't find a worker, an American. And so he says, well, look, is anybody help me find somebody? I got something to do. This economy's growing, see? 4.7% unemployment rate nationwide. Pretty good numbers. And people are having trouble finding work that Americans won't do. And that's a fact of life. And so he says, why don't you send somebody over to help me? And they show up and they put a Social Security card out there. And it looks real. You know, our small business owners are not document checkers.
Oh, it's just small business owners. Just small business owners, folks. It's not major corporations. It's not major agribusiness. This has nothing to do with NAFTA shredding the work of literally millions of campesinos. This has nothing to do with our agriculture subsidies, basically forcing farmers from the rural parts of Mexico into the cities to find there's no jobs there. No, see, that's to do with a guy in Central Texas. A small business operation, a Dairy Queen. Sean wants AWOL. We will reschedule because I have a feeling George Bush won't do anything to change his place as worst president in the history of the United States.
We're after an essay about the worst phone guest.
Yeah, there you go. We'll take your calls at 866-303-2270, 866-303-2270. The fifth item, folks, for George Bush.
Now go back.
To make his comeback, what?
This is the list from Time Magazine.
Yeah, this is the list from Time Magazine, and this is how he plans to make his comeback. We've already gone over the four points of the five-point plan.
Who wrote this? The new chief of staff,
Josh Bolton. And apparently he wants to get rid of Harriet Myers.
That actually is not a bad idea.
Whoa, wait. This is the woman that George Bush said was the best candidate in the entire country to sit on the Supreme Court, and now she's not good enough? Now she's not good enough to be White House counsel? She's not good enough to continue to make the schedule for the White House?
Supreme Court or bust.
You know why she's not going to get fired? Because she knows too much. She's got to stay in the fold. Because God knows what happens. George Bush will crush her. Crush her if she cuts her way. You remember those the greeting cards she sent him?
Yeah, they were really crazy.
You are the most intelligent man I've ever met. You are the greatest president in the history of... You're not even president yet. I'm writing this while you're still governor, and I think you're the greatest president ever. So George Bush's five-point plan to come back. One, deploy guns and badges. Just hire a bunch of guys, put them on ATVs down at the border, buff them up, drive around on the ATV, take some photo ops. So that you can let your nativists, the racist and the nativists and the xenophobes in the Republican Party know that you are all for stopping the illegal immigrants by driving around on ATVs. Number two, make Wall Street happy. He hasn't been doing this already? Has there been a single policy this the Bush administration has pursued that has not benefited Wall Street? Number three, brag more. Well, that's going to take, I think, a little bit more halcyon. Whatever they're putting in, whatever cocktail he's on, he's going to need a little bit more of those, of some of those serotonin inhibitors, I think, to just get to that point where he's feeling real cocky. You know, we got a saying in Texas. It's called dead or alive. Wait a second. No, it's called get them dead or alive. And that's what we're going to do with that President Mama John in Iran. We're going to get him. Number four, reclaim security credibility. In other words, lie faster, I guess. And number five, what the American public has been demanding. Is it going to actually be any new policies? Is it going to be an attempt to deal with the rising price of gas? No. Court the press. Nope. Administration officials said
what did you mean to hit?
The White House can work more astutely with journalists to make its case to the public. If these journalists actually help the Bush administration anymore, invest in knee patches for these press people, if you know what I'm saying. He's going to be wearing out a lot of their knees and their pants. Let's go to line three. Sam in Memphis, Tennessee, welcome to the program, Sam. How you doing?
Good evening. I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Good. Yeah, I'm just passing through my way up to East Tennessee. We don't have, there are no liberal shows up there, and I get a kick out of listening to you when I'm where I can hear. Up until the night, though, quite frankly, most of what I've heard has been utter nonsense.
Really?
With some of the other talkers. Yeah, basically what I hear is a mantra. We hate Bush. But there's nothing intelligent comes out other than that.
Well, what do you want me to tell you? I mean, I don't hate George Bush. I can go through a list of his policies. Did you hear what I said about the CIA, Chief?
I've heard quite a bit of you. I agree.
Now, do you think that he served, when he served under Bush for 5 or 6 years, do you think he hated Bush during that whole time? Or do you think he resented the fact that every piece of intelligence that told him that Iraq was not a threat, do you think that he hated the fact that everything that he had based his 27-year career on was being thrown out the window because of an agenda?
Oh, I agree, exactly. That's one of the things. I voted for Bush, and quite frankly, I kind of hate I did it.
Well,
I considered Bush the lesser of the evils. I'll be totally blunt.
Well, I mean, I don't know how much, I mean, I don't know what you thought John Kerry was going to do, but I mean, this man lied you into a war. You don't care about that?
Well, I'm not 100% sure of all the lies. I'd like to see more of the intelligence, which I don't have access to. But
let me ask you this. Hold on for a second, Sam. Hold on. What is it going to take for you to believe? I mean, is this guy going to have to come to your house? Is this guy Drumheller, is he going to have to come to your house with a dossier telling you all this stuff? Are you going to be able to read it? I mean, what is it going to take? Tell me what will verify to you that this guy lied to you.
Oh, as far, you talk about Bush as far as weapons of mass destruction?
Yeah.
I can tell you right now, I believe the weapons of mass destruction are there. They're not in Iraq. They're in Syria. Because if you go back to Gulf War I, we know for a fact there were a lot of stuff left over.
So do you believe, hold on for a second, Sam, I get your point. Do you believe that all those weapons inspectors who said that they destroyed those weapons from 91 to 98, you believe that they were lying?
I believe that they didn't destroy as much as they said they did.
Well, why do you think they're lying when all the evidence proves to their being right? And you don't think Bush lied when all the evidence proves to him lying?
Oh, I'm pretty sure that Bush lied about some stuff, too. I even remember seeing one thing where, so I said, they're going to find nerve gas even if they have trucked it in by UPS.
Right. And but you have secret information that they moved it to Syria. Okay.
No, I don't have secret information, but I do. I've seen some reports where there's some.
Were they on Fox by any chance, Sam?
But, yeah, no, I don't know if it is or not, obviously.
Okay.
I don't really know.
So what else is your point?
But I've got a couple of points real quick. Number one, I agree with you on Bush and Lockheed, so I think he's going to be the worst president in America, and I hate to say that, unfortunately.
Yes.
I don't trust him. I think he's lying about a number of things.
Mm-hmm.
I think he lied about...
Sounds like you hate him, but go ahead.
But there's a couple of things that that have bugged me, though, about the comments you made. I've heard, see, I keep hearing lies on y'all's side, too.
All right, well, listen, Sam.
Old tired stuff about
Sam. Just be specific. We only got 30 seconds left.
Okay. Number one, Bush did not steal the election. If anything, Gore tried to, and that's been proven.
Wait. Where has that been proven? Do you know the General Accountability Office, Sam? The Government Accountability Office says that what went on in Ohio was borderline criminal. But what's the next thing?
Biggles in New Orleans. I keep hearing about how Bush messed up New Orleans. I hate to disillusion y'all on that, but Ray Nagin screwed up New Orleans. When the federal government finally got involved, yeah, they screwed up because Bush had an idiot for FEMA director. I know I've been in
Who appointed him?
30 years.
Who appointed him?
Ray Nagin screwed up New Orleans. That new governor did.
All right, Sam. I appreciate the phone call. We got to go. Ray Nagin may have screwed up New Orleans, but the bottom line is the FEMA dropped the ball. And if you're very proud of the fact that Ray Nagin's a Democrat, the guy was a Republican 3 weeks before he ran for mayor. Literally. He switched over to be a Democrat. I don't care. There isn't anybody in this country who doesn't believe that the FEMA screwed up. And there isn't anybody who doesn't think that's because George Bush appointed a crony. We'll be right back on the Majority Report, Air America Radio.
The best of the Majority Report on Air America Radio.
The odds of you being killed by a terrorist are practically zero. So I say relax and enjoy the show. You have to be a realist. You have to be realistic about terrorism. Certain groups of people, certain groups, Muslim fundamentalists, Christian fundamentalists, Jewish fundamentalists, and just plain guys from Montana, are going to continue to make life in this country very interesting for a long, long time. That's the reality. Angry men in combat fatigues talking to God on a two-way radio and muttering incoherent slogans about freedom are eventually going to provide us with a great deal of entertainment, especially after your stupid economy collapses all around you and the terrorists come out of the woodwork. You'll have anthrax in the water supply, sarin gas in your air conditioners. There'll be chemical and biological suitcase bombs in every city. And I say, enjoy it. Relax. Enjoy the show. Take a chance. Put a little fun in your life.
CBS News. I'm Harley Carnes.
They may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom!
Actor Mel Gibson has resumed an ongoing program for drinkers. That's from his publicist today, after his embarrassing arrest for driving drunk this weekend.
Very few details are being released about the type of treatment Mel Gibson is receiving. A brief statement from his publicist says the actor-director is participating in an ongoing program to deal with this. Gibson said this past weekend that he's been dealing with alcoholism his entire adult life.
That's CBS News correspondent Steve Futterman. The arresting sheriff's deputy, by the way, says he does not want to get into anything Gibson said to him while he was under the influence. Says he hopes he'll think twice before getting behind the wheel of a car after drinking from now on. Those are people packing it up in Vintage Abile. and they're getting out before the next round of fighting between Israeli troops and Hezbollah.
I'm Dan Raviv in Tel Aviv. Israel says when the 48-hour suspension of airstrikes requested by Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice expires, that'll be early Wednesday morning, the bombing will resume, targeting Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. And senior ministers in the security cabinet approved a wider ground offensive. Tanks and troops have been seen heading for the Lebanese border.
CBS's Vicky Barker is in Beirut.
The Israelis have given residents 24 hours to leave some of the worst hit areas, and a stream of civilians has been flowing from some of those villages heading towards Tyre. But that may be from frying pan to fire. The southern port city has been hit several times during this conflict.
The oops pill, the morning after pill, may soon be available over the counter to any woman 18 or older, just for the asking.
If the FDA adheres to its mandate and makes science-based decisions as opposed to politically motivated decisions, then Plan B will be over the counter and there will be no age restriction.
That's Vanessa Cullins at Planned Parenthood. Ann Scheidler at the Pro-Life Action League does not like the idea.
We believe that massive doses of artificial hormones are not a good idea for anybody of any age.
The morning after pill prevents pregnancy, unlike RU486, which aborts one. It's hot. It's dang hot.
Yeah, I mopped the kitchen floor, the bathroom floor, keep it cool.
Emma Taylor in Chicago, mopping the floor, one of many, many ways people try to keep just a little bit cooler. Others who can head for pools and streams and showers, or they soak in the tub, turn on the fan, knowing at least that this, too, shall pass. On Wall Street, the Dow lost 34 points to close at 11,185. The NASDAQ was off nearly 3 points today. Oil prices, $74.40 a barrel, up $1.16. This is CBS News.
Somewhere between what a person is saying and what they're not saying, between what a person wants and what they need, lies understanding. For every client, everywhere, UBS has a distinct ability to listen. But more importantly, the commitment to understand. UBS, leader in wealth management, global asset management, and investment banking, and committed to a relationship we call you and us. Member SIPC.
Come into your local Goodyear retailer for the Goodyear MVP Tire Sale. Plus, get up to a $40 cash card with a purchase of four selected Goodyear tires. And ask how you can double your cash card value up to $80 on qualifying purchases. Our lineup is stacked from top to bottom with Goodyear's most valuable products, like the award-winning Assurance and Forterra tires featuring triple tread technology. Hurry, because both the Goodyear MVP Tire Sale and cash card offers end August 26th. Call 1-800-GOODYEAR for the complete details and the retailer near you. Certain restrictions apply.
Iran, as a nuclear-armed nation, is a non-starter, says the United Nations, which gives Iran a month to get out of the pursuit of it.
At the State Department, spokesman Sean McCormick says the UN Security Council has made very clear to Iran that it must stop its uranium enrichment program by the end of August.
The spotlight is on them to see whether or not they're going to make those tough decision.
McCormick says key Security Council members have a general agreement on sanctions that would be imposed if Iran's nuclear activities continue.
There was a menu, if you will, of possible sanctions.
Iran claims the UN deadline makes negotiations more difficult. John Harchi, CBS News, Washington.
Not everyone is bothered by high gasoline prices. There's Willie Nelson, of course, with his vegetable oil-powered tour bus, and Keenan Corbus, who says vegetable oil works in his F-250 Ford truck, even in Anchorage, Alaska, where it gets really cold. And when it's running, whether plowing snow or doing work, he says it smells like French fries, and dogs come to check it out. Harley Carnes.
Fabulous skin treatments, silky smooth legs, rejuvenating facials. Yes, you get amazing options at Sona Med Spa. Sona can help you reveal yourself, whether it be beautiful skin.
Hey, listen up. What about your future? Are you unhappy with your current job? Want to make great money and get the promotion you deserve? Now's the time. Explore your options. Log on to sackjobs.com and post your resume today. That's sackjobs.com. Post your resume and have local employers find you now. New companies being added each day and hundreds of jobs being added each week. So if you're in the market for a job, sackjobs.com is a click away. At sackjobs.com, you're on your way to a better day.
The best of the Majority Report on Air America Radio.
We are back on the Majority Report, Air America Radio, streaming at airamericaradio.com, blogging at the Nobel-nominated blog, MajorityReportRadio.com. My name is Sam Cedar. Janine Garofalo will be in later in the program on the phone. The editor of the New Yorker magazine and the author of the new collection reporting Writings from the New Yorker, David Remnick. It's a real pleasure. Welcome to the program, David.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
David, I'm looking at your book, Reporting, available now, I assume, everywhere.
I hope so.
And otherwise you're going to have a problem. Tell me, now, I'm looking through, and you have basically, you have five different sections of the book. Let's start with the first one. It's a series of essays, which you start with Al Gore, and you end with a story basically from New Orleans on Katrina. Tell me a little bit about your perspective and your experience talking to Al Gore.
Well, I did this piece when he was kind of just beginning this, I would call it a kind of wilderness campaign against Bush. As you know, after he quote unquote lost the election in 2000, he went quiet for a while and did some rather quiet teaching jobs and grew a beard and traveled a little bit. I mean, there was a lot to absorb. I mean, it's hard enough for everybody else to understand what happened in 2000, much less to be the person yourself. And then he started giving these very, very sharp, stinging speeches on Iraq, on civil liberties, on a number of things against the Bush administration. Policy-oriented speeches that many people felt, as soon as they heard them, were precisely what he wasn't doing in the campaign. Now, arguably, that's not what you can do in a national campaign sometimes. I mean, that's a discussion, too.
And also, you're basically, you can't really critique what a guy has done when he hasn't really done anything.
In terms of the Bush administration.
Exactly. I mean, there was no Bush administration.
I think that's fair. And I think also, remember, Bush campaigned on the slogan long forgotten of relative isolationism in foreign policy and in domestic policy, compassionate conservatism.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, everybody knew he'd be to the right of Al Gore, but how far to the right and the degree of what can only be called a kind of radicalism was really unknown to most. And so, you know, Gore came along and really started with these speeches and had a lot to say. And at the same time, you know, when I was doing this profile, you know, still had some of the old, I guess you could call them faults or ticks or whatever they are that kept some of the voters out of his column.
What do you think those faults or ticks were? I mean, I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just curious.
Well, everybody's got faults. Everybody's got drawbacks. And I think Gore's were always highlighted by his running mate, by Clinton. Clinton was, according to anybody that you talk to, whether they're inside or outside, the most, the natural, the kind of Joe DiMaggio of contemporary politics. Extremely people-oriented, mediagenic, if that's an English word. Somebody who gained energy by crowds rather than was depleted by that experience. Whereas Gore is a more introverted fellow and somebody who, when the camera light went on, suddenly lost his kind of natural wit and went stiff on you. And also in those debates, it's maybe hard to remember now, in those debates with Bush, he was kind of in search of a personality.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's himself. Now he's relaxed. And now who knows what would happen if he ran for president, whether he would revert to that earlier incarnation that we're talking about, or he might feel, what the hell, I'm just gonna throw it high and hard.
And what do you think the impact of him going around and being so outspoken has been? Because there's really never been an analogous situation. I mean, the way the 2000 election was resolved was...
Well, there were three people in American history who lost popular elections, and two of them came back to run and win. Andrew Jackson was first and foremost. But, you know, I think I'm getting my history right there. I think, though, the way Gore lost and this whole phenomenon of hanging chads and winning by 500,000 votes in the popular vote, and also the great, I don't know what to call it, the great sense of national unity that he showed in stepping aside when he really was faced with little choice, I think showed tremendous character.
Do you ever think he got credit for that?
Well, in certain circles, certainly in our magazine, he did. Rick Hertzberg, who writes Comment for us, probably wrote one of his best and most moving columns when Gore made his concession speech. Now, I have to say, Gore's profile has only gone more into relief and even got any higher in recent weeks, and I think will in coming weeks too, since he started this round of previews of his film, An Inconvenient Truth.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the film shows his enormous commitment to a huge policy question, a question of survival, which is obviously global warming. And at the same time, and I think the film will do a lot positive for Gore should he decide to capitalize on it. But still, his political popularity is not enormous. Those who love him, but those who always had hesitations about him for one reason or another are still there. So it's not a given that he'll jump into the race, and it's not a given that he would necessarily go very far. And I'm not sure that he is exactly up for a repeat of a psychodrama involving the Clintons and the Gores yet again. I mean, it's a lot of animosity, a lot of bad feeling coming out of the 2000 race between those families. And one wonders whether he's up for that.
All right, we're talking to David Remnick about his new book, Reporting. He is the editor of the New Yorker magazine, and this is a collection of his of writings from the New Yorker. Now, you start that section off with Al Gore, and you finish it with High Water, a piece on Katrina. Tell me a little bit about what you found when you went down to New Orleans and why.
Well, I went down to New Orleans just a few days after the worst flooding. And, you know, the difficult thing for a journalist or any writer that goes to an event where there's lots of people on hand is to figure out a different way to tell the story and maybe a more effective way if you can do it. And even the New Yorker, we had three people there. John Lee Anderson was there and Dan Baum, who was engaged in doing a much more long-term project. And all these things have since been published. And we'll do a lot more because it's such an enormous thing. But I went down there to do something quick, and I think political.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I saw what you saw, flooding, the political cynicism, the terrible suffering, the migration to places like Houston and other cities in Texas and Louisiana and so on. But I swear to you, by just sort of flipping around the internet and figuring out how other political figures in the past had dealt with such similar crises, I made my way into the Johnson Library, which has many of its papers online, and came across an incredible document in which Johnson receives an appeal from Senator Long of Louisiana to go immediately to Louisiana after a nearly similar catastrophic flood in 1965. And Johnson was told by Senator Long, look, you lost this state last time. If you want to run for re-election, Lyndon, you've got to come down and show some love. You've got to show that you understand what's going on. So he was appealed to on raw political terms. It wasn't all idealism. But Johnson understood that and got on the plane that day. And he wandered around in shelters with a flashlight and saying, you know, I'm here. The leader of the free world is here. I'm here for you. And he listened. And as we all know, a large part of what the President of the United States can do is display his presence, to show his compassion, to shine a light on a particular issue in a period of time, which, of course, by inference, is exactly what George Bush took way too long doing.
And so now, am I wrong in drawing the conclusion that there may have not been a political incentive for George Bush to take this seriously?
No, obviously there was a political incentive, but he just missed it. He didn't understand it. He didn't get it for whatever reason, whether it had to do with geography or race or whatever. He clearly, and I hate the overused word, he didn't get it. And when he got around to getting it, it was too late. And when people say, why is George Bush's popularity rating now in the, 30% or whatever it might be?
Yeah, I mean,
I think it's pretty simple. Iraq, and with a healthy dose of Katrina.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, do you also think it's shown a light, because the problems with FEMA and the problems with the recovery effort were seeds that were planted at the beginning of his term.
I think that's absolutely true, but I also want to say something that may be less popular to say, and that is this was a gigantic disaster, and there's blame to go around for everybody. The state of Louisiana, the city of New Orleans, the federal government, previous presidents, the degree of negligence, there's enough blame to go around. But when it came to the President of the United States, in the moment, the business of flying over the flooding and kind of looking out, through the window, and that's just lousy politics. It's as raw as that.
Right.
And he just didn't get around to coming until days later, and people saw that. And at the same time, they saw who was suffering most, in the main, black people, not only, and they drew their conclusions, fair or not.
And, to be fair to the president, my understanding is that he was concerned about his weight gain, and he wanted to get a couple more bike rides in his villa in Crawford.
I think that's probably the only thing we have said tonight that's not exactly fair to the president, but what the hell.
All right. We'll be right back. David, please stay with us. We're talking to David Remnick. He is the editor from the New Yorker magazine, and he's talking about his new collection, Reporting, Writings from the New Yorker. We'll be right back on The Majority Report.
The best of The Majority Report on Air America Radio.
A liberal dose of the truth.
These boys and girls are not spare parts.
Applied daily. AM 1320, Sacramento's left channel.
You know something? There's nothing wrong with a culture where everyone has a different idea of what's humorous. The last time I can remember an entire nation being on the same page, it was Germany in the late 30s, and it didn't really turn out that funny. Remember, in its time and place, what Hitler said was considered politically correct. And it's that blind adherence to what is situationally palatable that is truly dangerous. We should question it all, poke fun at it all, sick on it all, rail against it all, and most importantly, for Christ's sake, laugh at it all. Because the only thing separating Holy Writ from complete disorder is your perspective. It's your only weapon. Keep the safety off. Don't take yourself too seriously. Remember that at the end of the day, this is just an ant farm with beepers, and it takes zero politically correct society to screw in a light bulb, because they are perpetually in the dark. Of course, that's just my opinion. I could be wrong.
$4 a gallon now, something?
Whoa. You know, there's a sign at the gas station in my house. It says, we take Visa, MasterCard, Discover Card, and American Express. After I filled up my car, they took my Visa, MasterCard, Discover Card. how expensive gas is here in California. Today, Charlie Sheen and Denise Richards were seen carpooling to their divorce attorney's office. They had no choice. In fact, they said on the news tonight, if gas prices get any higher, we could see something totally unprecedented here in California. People actually walking. Yes, this has never happened. Again, this is all theory. It looks like some help might be on the way. They announced today they are opening a suicide hotline for SUV owners. So I think that's going to be a good sign. That's a step in the right direction.
Laughing at the truth. AM 1320. Back to Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Air America Radio.
We are talking to David Remnick. He's the editor of the New Yorker magazine and author of the new collection, Reporting, Writings from the New Yorker. And it's a fantastic book that covers both, I guess, politics, fiction writing, Russia, former Soviet Union, what's going on in Israel, and boxing. But I want to ask you, David, you've been a reporter, a journalist, I guess, for some time. How has your role as a journalist, maybe not specifically yours, but the role of a journalist changed through the years? I mean, specifically now, Alberto Gonzalez this weekend basically said that they're willing to go after reporters who are reporting on the bad things that the government is doing.
It hasn't. You know, I work with, for example, Cy Hirsch, who's a great investigative reporter and has been for a long time. And he's been through this, you know. He's the business of getting wiretapped or, denounced and all this stuff. And, you know, my feeling about it is the work hasn't changed. And, you know, it's unbelievably unfortunate, to say the least, that the government would behave like this, but it's not the first time. It's probably the worst it's been since the Nixon administration. But you get tough and you do what you're supposed to do, and you do it without rancor, and you put your head down and you report and you report and you report, and that's what I hope we're doing at the New Yorker, and I don't think we're alone. I think the notion, I was talking to somebody today who was completely gripped by the idea that somehow the press has gone completely soft. And has the press performed less well on some stories than they have on others? Absolutely. I mean, I don't think there's a reporter around that thinks that the press overall performed well on the WMD story, for example. In retrospect, I'm not quite sure how we could have gotten it. But who knows? That was not a great chapter in the history of the American newspapers or magazines or television. On the other hand, the recent Pulitzer Prizes, in which the New York Times won for uncovering NSA wiretaps, and the Washington Post won for its work on secret prisons, the New Yorker's work on Abu Ghraib, and by Cy Hirsch, and Jane Mayer's work on torture. I mean, all these things tell me that there are reporters who know precisely what to do and are completely unintimidated.
Well, I mean, I agree with you that there are certainly reporters out there who are doing, thankfully, a better job than they were doing, you know, 4 or 5 years ago.
And Watergate was uncovered essentially by two reporters in one newspaper. So it's you.
So you don't think there's been a fundamental change in the way that the press views itself since that time?
Since Watergate.
Yeah, in terms of their relationship with the administration, or, you know, I mean...
No, I think there have always been weak reporters and there have always been strong reporters. I don't think somebody woke up, you know, a few years ago and said, here, let's get the journalistic union, secret union together and let's get really weak. No,
well,
I don't think that happened.
You don't think that the consolidation of media has maybe not necessarily conspired to do that, but at least provided
a healthy trend. There's no doubt about that. But let's face it, the very best newspapers, and newspapers is what still drives the press. I'm thrilled about the internet, and television has its potential that it usually remains untapped. But it's the leading newspapers that drive the press for the most part. And those papers, what are we talking about? We're talking about the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and with the exception of the LA Times, which is part of a bigger conglomerate, I don't think is part of that trend. The Times and the Post are family-owned newspapers. The company I belong to is a family-owned private company.
Don't you think that the New York Times has had to respond to that? I mean, didn't they just come out with, 4 or 5 months ago saying they were going to try and make their paper appeal more to red staters, whatever that means?
No. No, I don't think they're saying that at all. I think they...
No, I mean, I didn't say that. They said that.
Pardon me?
I didn't say that. They said that.
No, they didn't. And I do think that any newspaper from a place like New York or L.A. would do well to cover red states a lot better than they do. That's quite a different thing.
Okay.
That's a very different thing and a desirable thing. It's probably true of the New Yorker. We could do a hell of a lot better job writing about what we cynically call the flyover states, everything
All right.
between New York and Los Angeles.
David, we're out of time, but thank you so much. The book is Reporting, Writings from the New Yorker. David Remnick, thank you again.
The best of the majority.
You're listening to
AM 1320 America Radio.
Sacramento's Left Channel. Left Channel. Streaming live at AM1320LeftChannel.com.
It's the best bike vacation ever. 3 days of cycling in the Sierra foothills, camping under the stars, catered gourmet meals, entertainment, and in-camp activities. It's the 20th annual Emigrant Trails Bike Trek, Friday, September 8th through Sunday, September 10th. This excellent adventure attracts over 400 bicycle riders and helps support Breathe California Sacramento's efforts to improve air quality in our area and to work to eliminate lung disease. Make your plans now and start raising much-needed funds by registering today at sacbreathe.org or by calling 916-444-5900. You can ride as an individual or put together a team of co-workers or friends. Travel at your own pace through stunning scenery, then relax in a camp with massage, yoga, or a beverage from the cantina. Free training rides prepare you for the best bike vacation ever. The 20th Annual Immigrant Trails Bike Trek, September 8th through September 10th. 3 days of cycling, camping, and fun. Go to sacbreathe.org or call 916-444-5900 and sign up today.
Streaming listeners, open your media player and click on the link to NoHaggleMortgage.com right now, and you can save thousands on your mortgage loan. It's simple, easy, and takes less than 30 seconds. For the first time, homeowners can now have direct access to the same rates that mortgage brokers get.
That's right, the same rates that mortgage brokers get.
Three things allow NoHaggleMortgage.com to get the lowest mortgage rates in the industry. One, no commissions to pay to loan officers. Two, most of the work is done over the internet, saving you a lot of money.
Three, no haggling. Click on the link now, then click on Quick Quote to find out what rate you can get. Get your money faster and save thousands. No gimmicks, no middleman, no haggling. Just simple, fast, friendly, low-rate mortgage loans. Skip the loan officer. Go direct to nohagglemortgage.com. You're already online. Take 30 seconds and find out for yourself. Or go to nohagglemortgage.com. Check it out today. Licensed by the DOC.
Welcome to Los Angeles, where I believe the official sunscreen is now lead, isn't it, pretty much? Oh, my God, this heat. I was sweating like Naomi Campbell trying to hire a maid. It was so hot today. It was so hot in Hollywood today. Brad and Angelina adopted Ben and Jerry. Did you know that? It was so hot in Encino. Michael Jackson actually stopped at a young boy's lemonade stand and just bought the lemonade. You know the worst part about this heat wave across the country is Al Gore walking around going, I told you so. Actually, if Al Gore's movie on global warming is correct, as you know, the ice caps are shrinking. You all know about that. The glaciers are shrinking. The only thing not shrinking, Al Gore, apparently. Have you seen Al? Really not shrinking. I tell you, the heat, it puts people in a bad mood. You know, in fact, coming into work today, people were swearing like President Bush near an open mic. It was unbelievable.
Laughing at the truth. AM 1320.
Banner. Spanish language version is going to be sung by a bunch of Spanish celebrities. Our national anthem is now a ditty for immigrants to sing as they stream across our broken borders. Lou Dobbs must be turning in his grave. Dobbs is dead, right? Anyway. This disgusting display of un-Americanism brings us to tonight's word. English! As in the official language of the United States of America. If we surrender our national anthem to Spanish, where does it end? Next thing you know, they'll be translating the Bible. God wrote it in English for a reason.
Laughing at the truth. AM 1320.
Of the Majority Report on Air America Radio. Now, Sam Cedar on the Majority Report, Air America Radio.
We are back on the Majority Report, Air America Radio, streaming at airamericaradio.com, blogging at majorityreportradio.com. My name is Sam Cedar. Janine Garofalo will be with us tomorrow night. But in studio with us tonight, it is a real pleasure for me to welcome Eric Massa, one of our fighting Dems who's been here before, running for Congress in New York's 29th District. MassaForCongress.com, M-A-S-S-A for Congress.com. And it's a real pleasure to welcome into our studio for the first time Senator Max Cleland from Georgia, former senator from Georgia, and I guess was awarded the Silver Star and the Bronze Star for action in combat in Vietnam. Welcome, gentlemen, both of you, to the Majority Report.
Well, thank you very much. I think with Eric Massa's victory in upstate New York, I think we have an excellent chance to take back the majority in the House. More and more, we see this. We see the polling data. It says that in the latest USA Today poll, the president is at his lowest level ever in the USA Today poll. He's dropped 9 points since January. We've seen gas prices double since he's been in the White House. That is killing the middle class in America mm-hmm. and the average citizen that goes to work every day, particularly in terms of transportation. It's also killing our airlines and threatening our automobile industry. We're losing jobs. We're losing credibility in the world with the war in Iraq. A guy like Eric Massa steps into this chaos and says, I've served my country for more than 24 years in the United States Navy. I'm a graduate of the Naval Academy. I took an oath to the Constitution to support it and to defend it against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And now we see some threats internally to this Constitution. And so I think there is a movement abroad in this country to take back our country, to restore some dignity and honor, to our government in Washington and new faces, new people with credible backgrounds who will tell the truth to the American people, like here at Massa, are going to be the winners in November. So I think here on the Majority Report, we got one of the people tonight that's going to make it possible for the Democrats to have a majority in Washington, in the House, and therefore expose the Bush administration for what it truly is.
Yeah, I agree with you. I couldn't have said it better myself. Now, Eric, you got some good news today. I mean, certainly, first of all, in the New York Times today, it stated that your opponent is one of the most, I guess, endangered Republicans, congressmen in the entire country. And you got some great poll news today.
Well, that's true. And thank you for having us here today. And, you know, I walk in the shadow of greatness and have the honor to be here today with Senator Cleland, who has inspired so many of the fighting Democrats, now more than 70 strong, in almost every state in this country, who are standing up to bring a higher standard of leadership to Washington, D.C., and return integrity and honesty and service. Yes, we did get very good news. And, you know, I'm not very focused on poll numbers, but we do know, because I've been to thousands of families over the last 18 months, talking with working Americans who are tired of seeing their jobs go to China, their neighbors go to Iraq, and their port security go to Dubai. There is an honest-to-goodness outcry in this nation today to restore the support for the middle class and to come to the rescue of working Americans all over the country. And we see it more, no more than anywhere else than in my home district in the 29th in upstate New York. Sometimes called the land that Washington, D.C. has forgotten. Certainly our representative, who is there now as an incumbent, has forgotten what it means to fill up a car with gas or to try to feed a family. And we need to restore leadership to Washington to bring that reality back.
You know, there's a story today, and I'm sure you're aware of this, that President Bush and Republicans in Congress and in the Senate have decided that the way that they're going to somehow increase their political chances is to cut taxes again for those people who basically make anywhere over $10 million a year in capital gains. I mean, that's really, when you talk about capital gains, those are the people who are going to be making money. And it is astonishing. Your opponent has voted with George Bush. I don't know if he's the number one Republican in the House who's voted. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, he's very proud of saying himself, and he did so on the front pages of the Elmira newspapers, that he stands with George Bush more than any other Republican. And he invites George Bush to come back to the district over and over and over again. If he wants to run on George Bush's coattails, goodness for him. That's signing up to be the navigator on the Titanic. Mm-hmm. And the people of this district know that. When you talk about tax cuts, what you're talking about is theft from our children. This is not cutting taxes for working Americans. This is stealing from the next generation. And I'll tell you this, and I hope your readers take it to the bank. George W. Bush is a fantastic president. He's one of the best presidents we've ever had for 1% of the population. We now need leadership for the other 99% of Americans, and that's what this race is all about.
That's well stated. And now, Max, Senator, excuse me, why have you gotten involved in this fighting Dems thing? I mean, when this whole thing started, we started inviting Democrats who were running, veterans. And we thought, well, okay, there'll be 10 or 12 of these guys, and we'll have it wrapped up in a couple of months, and the series will be over, and maybe we'll be able to invite them back. And now there's, Eric Massa said, there's nearly 70 guys who've come back, either recently come back from Iraq or have served in the U.S. military. I think the Republicans are running maybe one or two veterans. Why did you get involved in the fighting Dems?
Because I am one. I've been fighting a long time. As a Vietnam veteran, my heart goes out to these veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan and the families that see them go and the 2,500 that we lost and the 20,000 that are wounded and the 500,000 that have come back now. And I'm seeing Vietnam all over again. And I know how this movie turns out, which is why I can't sit idly by and just twiddle my thumbs. I got to get involved somehow. As you know, I got involved with John Kerry. That didn't work out. But now we have people who, much like George Washington said, when I took upon the soldier, I did not lay aside the citizen. And after they've left their responsibilities as a soldier, they come back, and they're veterans, and they've got a tremendous stake in the future of the country already. They have risked a lot for it, and they are taking up the role of a citizen and saying, I want to do my part to turn this country around. And I can't sit by and just see them go off by themselves. So I've taken an interest in people that originally Washington, even the Democratic Party officials, didn't take an interest in. People like Eric Massa here in New York. People like Mike Weaver in Kentucky. People like Jay Fawcett in Colorado. Charlie Brown in Sacramento. And a host of others out there, many of which don't make the front page of the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
I'm lucky to make the Elmira paper. But these are people who have served their country and who are out there serving it again, and all of which took an oath to support and defend this country and its Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and they're fighting for it again. So that kind of, I don't know, commitment inspires me to go out and do what I can on their behalf. Whether or not Democratic Party officials in Washington acknowledge their viability or not, whether or not anybody cares about them, whether or not anybody supports them, I do. And more and more people around America are. And it just works out that this over 70 veterans out there, the fighting Dems running against incumbent Republicans and in open seats, are really the tip of the spear here for change in America, to take the country back, to get it on the right track, to make sure we bring our sons and daughters home from Iraq, and then focus our American military on rebuilding and recovering and going after Osama bin Laden and building a coalition around the world to do that. I mean, these people understand. They get it. They know what they're doing. And the American people are hungry for that kind of leadership. They're also trustworthy and honest, and they're not going to lie, cheat, and steal. And what we've seen in Washington with this Republican culture of corruption, from the White House down to the U.S. House in particular, is that it's being eaten alive by corruption. It is being eaten alive by people we cannot trust anymore. So whether you're a Democrat, Republican, Greenie, Independent, or not even registered to vote, more and more you're concerned about the future of this country, and rightfully so, because it is going in the wrong direction, and the only way we're going to turn it around and put it in the right direction is by electing people in November who have the courage and the commitment and the integrity to do the right thing when they get to Washington. That's Eric Massa. That's why I'm here in New York.
You know, I mean, I've said many times in this program that when you have an ideology like the conservative ideology that hates government, it's not and hates its regulations, hates its laws, sees it as an impediment to enriching yourselves, it's no wonder that you get this level of corruption when it is dominated by that ideology. Now, speaking of responsibility...
May I say?
Please.
They don't hate government. They want it in every woman's vagina.
Right.
They want it in every woman's womb. They want it in every operating room where your grandmother is laying there dying and you have to decide to pull the plug. No. We are the genuine conservatives. People like Eric Massa, who lay there dying of terminal cancer and had to come to terms with this with his wife on when to pull the plug and so forth. He didn't want Tom to lay in the room. I don't want him in the room. You don't want him in the room. And most Americans really got a dose of this when they saw the Terry Schiavo case.
Right.
And this government and this president and Tom DeLay trying to go into the private lives of somebody and tell them about their own family situation to pull the plug or not. And so you had the governor of Florida, Jeb Bush, involved. The president of the United States. No, these people don't know. So stay the hell out of our personal lives. Leave issues like family planning, prayer, and when to pull the plug on your relatives. Those are personal decisions. You look after the defense of the country, which you're screwing up right now. You look after Homeland Security, which you can't get done. And you look after the doggone gas prices that are killing the average American. That's what you should be looking after. And that's the message the American people want to hear.
All right. We're talking to former Senator Max Cleland and... Congressional candidate in New York's 29th District, Eric Massa. When we come back, Eric, I want to ask you about the Fighting Dems petition to fire Donald Rumsfeld. And Senator Cleland, I want to ask you when you come back, You mentioned responsibility. I want to ask your opinion of the Senate's responsibility for oversight for an executive branch that seems to have completely run amok and run afoul of the Constitution. We'll be right back on the Majority Report, Air America Radio.
The best of the Majority Report on Air America Radio.
A liberal dose of the truth.
The internet is not something that you just dump something on. It's not a big truck. It's a series of truth.
Applied daily. AM 1320.
At Cache Creek Casino Resort, win fast, win often with Cache Fever Jackpot. Jackpots start at $20,000 and are guaranteed to hit by $30,000. Every time a Cache Fever Jackpot hits, a Cash Club player wins just for playing with their card. Plus, you can check the Cache Fever Jackpot total and your Cash Club points online now at CacheCreek.com. So join Cash Club today and get the fever. Cache Creek Casino Resort.
Talking to former Senator Max Cleland of Georgia and fighting Dem Eric Massa running for Congress in New York's 29th district. Now, Eric, and you just told me during the break something I didn't know, that you were the first candidate, Democrat or Republican, to declare his candidacy the day after George Bush supposedly won re-election in 2004. And, you know, you've come a long way. And I want to just talk about the fighting Dems. They have basically signed a petition, I guess it is, calling on George Bush to fire Donald Rumsfeld. Why have you done this?
Well, we saw a number of general and flag officers coming out of retirement to go to the American people and remind us all that we took an oath to defend the Constitution, not to defend the President of the United States. There are ideals in this nation that are bigger than any individual, and we recognize that because we swore to defend those ideals. And I talked both via email and in person to as many of the fighting Dems as I could reach. We already have over 50 who have joined us to reinforce those generals. The generals are out on their walking point. They're on the Hill. They're taking fire from the likes of Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity, who have never worn the uniform and who would politicize their grandmothers.
Well, let me say, in all fairness to Rush Limbaugh, he had a pimple on his buttock. And that's why he couldn't make it into the service.
Well, that might be well true, and I know he has some other issues he's dealing with in the courts of Florida right now that would disqualify him from military service. But for him to attack, and for those individuals to attack the integrity of these general officers because they're standing firm in their beliefs, is unsupportable. And those of us who have worn the uniform are now coming to the reinforcement. We know that this Secretary of Defense is destroying our military. And we believe, you know, I took an oath at the U.S. Naval Academy, where I was honored to go, that I would not lie, cheat, or steal, or tolerate those who do. And I challenge every member of Congress to do the same, because we are all willing to do that. You know, my opponent accepted $20,000 from Tom DeLay and refuses to give it back. I'd rather accept $1 from 20,000 honest Americans than $20,000 from an indicted felon. And I share those values with all these fighting Dems who have now come forward to call for Dom Rensel's resignation with me.
All right. Well, it's Massa for Congress, folks. MassaForCongress.com. Visit it right now if you can, and show your support in any way that you can. I'm not sure how that could happen, but I'm sure someone will figure out a way. Now, Senator Cleland, I want to ask you this. There was a major story in the Boston Globe about these signing statements that George Bush has been essentially using to circumvent the law passed by Congress. And when you combine that with his warrantless spying, which is also in circumventing a congressional statute of FISA, what do you see in terms of the Senate upholding their responsibility for oversight of the president?
First of all, these signing statements are a violation of the president's oath. When he took an oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, didn't say support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, except those portions of the Constitution that I don't agree with. And he took an oath to abide by the laws of the United States. He didn't take an oath to abide by just some of the laws and ignore others. So we have a president of the United States that's violating his oath of office by those side agreements that are not law. That means that he actually is acting as king, not president. He's declaring himself his own law, and that is illegal. And that should be called by the Congress of the United States. You cannot break the law. And whether you're president of the United States or a member of Congress. And so the reason that the Congress has not called into question the unconstitutional act of this president, because they themselves are the rubber stamp of the president. Now, therein is a major problem, because our system is set up as three separate co-equal branches of government. The founding fathers understood human nature, and that is that if you put political power in the hands of one party or one part of the government, and it takes over all the parts of the government, you wind up with what we got now: massive injustice, massive corruption, and illegal acts. So part of the reason that so many people are gravitating to guys like Eric Massa and the fighting Dems around the country and Democrats who are running against incumbent Republicans is because they want to see a balance restored to our constitutional democracy. And they want to see the House of Representatives or the Senate taken over by the Democrats so that we can have some investigations and find out the truth about the war in Iraq, the truth about the violations regarding Homeland Security, and the truth about why the oil companies are winding up running off with the profits that they're running off with. So you won't have that. You won't have that. There's a stony silence, a tone deafness by Republican members of Congress that this country is outraged at. And so they're going to support guys like Eric Massa, and they're going to lead a revolution to make sure that the Congress does provide oversight. We're going to get to the truth of the Bush administration. And when that truth comes out, it'll be Katie bar the door. It was Joe Scarborough on Scarborough Report the other night that said that if we, that we have to, we, the Republicans, have to defend both houses of Congress and keep them. Otherwise, if the Democrats take them over, we'll all be indicted.
All right, Senator Max Cleland, thank you so much for joining us. Eric Massa, MassaForCongress.com, folks, MassaForCongress.com. Thanks so much for joining us, guys. We appreciate it. We'll be right back.
The best of the majority report.